Call the House Tax Committee meeting to order at 11:08 a.m. We do have a quorum. I will move House File 848. I will now move the A15-0509 amendment. So that's what we have before us, members. I think what we'll do before we get into the bill is we do have a couple amendments for me we could get on just to be where we want to be here. I think we'll start with the Simonson. I believe the A21-80848821 is the Simonson amendment, I believe. Is that correct? Okay, let's go with that. Let's talk about that. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A21 is an exact replica of a bill that I dropped later in the session with the understanding that there may possibly have to be a last-minute fix here. And essentially, Mr. Chair and members, this is dealing with current law for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority and their tax increment financing district. And I do believe that the lobbyist for the Seaway Port Authority is probably in the room and could speak very briefly if you wish, but essentially it's language regarding around the interfund loan that the Seaway Port Authority could establish before approval of the TIF financing plan, and allows the authority to make loans under the program, and the proceeds of the loan may be used for any permanent use of the increments. Now, there's nobody that I'm aware of that's opposed to this. I know the League of Minnesota Cities was working on some language, and I think that conversation has happened between the League and the Port Authority, and we don't have any problems there, but I do think, Mr. Chair, Bradley Peterson does represent the Port if you want him to speak briefly.
I think that'd be a good idea, Mr. Peterson. What changes are... Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty & Hood here today on behalf of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you could explain what changes we're making here, what the Simonson Amendment does.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. And this is really in response to the language that was originally introduced in House File 1123, which was your bill that you carried for the League. The initial draft of that bill caused some concern related to an interfund loan program that the Port Authority had approved in 2010 and whether or not it would still work. Subsequently, that language has been revised in the division report and has been fixed mostly, we think, but the language that's reflected here in Representative Simonson's amendment really is comfort language for the Port that they'll be able to continue to do what they've been doing and be within the law. The site that's in question, Mr. Chair, is a almost 600-acre site that's a former U.S. steel plant in West Duluth. It's a very complicated project. There was special legislation passed in 2009 related to this. And so rather than try to change or adjust the League's language to fit the Port Authority, we thought that it would be best to simply make the changes within the special authority that had already been granted to the Port in 2009.
Okay, now, Representative Simonson or Mr. Peterson, is this something that needed to go through Property Tax Division? Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, this is the exact language of a bill that I introduced maybe 2 weeks ago, and it was referred right to taxes. So I haven't had any conversation with either your staff or Chair Drazkowski as if it needed to be referred down to the division.
Okay. I think any other comments, Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, just to say that, you know, we realize that this is something of a last-minute request, but it really is in response to kind of the to and fro of legislative activity here, and the decision was made really over the weekend by the Port Authority that they felt like they needed this language.
Okay. I guess, is there anyone who wishes to testify on this amendment from the audience with concerns? Does the department have any... thing they'd like to say on this? Okay. I think what we'll do, I think we should maybe put this on with a caveat that if some of the property tax folks have some real concerns, we'll want to work through those. In fact, Chair Drazkowski's not here right now, but I'd say let's go ahead with the caveat that if this changes Western civilization as we know it, we may need to relook at it down the road here. So with that, any member questions? Okay, Representative Simonson renews his motion to add the amendment H08488821. Further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we'll just want to, I want to check with a few folks to make sure we're good with that. Okay, item next, I have an amendment to add a few things in here, and I want to have staff go over these, and also anything that I do, I want to make sure if we have not heard it, that we hear it now. So anything that's new that hasn't been in bill form. I know there's some vendor payments in there for sales tax. I know we heard several bills, I think three bills to that regard, but in the CNG, I think we heard that too. But let's go through, Mr. Michael, if you could go through, and members, you should have well, before we do that, Representative Simonson, you're on a roll here. Representative Simonson moves the April 20th, 2015 minutes. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Okay, members, you should have a sheet that kind of describes the author's amendment, the various provisions in here. And, Mr. Michael, as you go through it for the members, if you could highlight something if we have not heard this in bill form. I want to be very clear so we can hear that now. Maybe take a little more time looking at it. And then as far as the author's amendment, A32 amendment, is there anyone from the audience which testified on behalf of it with concerns? Would the department like to testify on this? No? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Michael, and so if you'd go through this, then we'll go to member questions on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on the first provision of the author's amendment is the underlying amendment extends the Angel credit, and in drafting that, we simply forgot, we extended the funding, but we forgot to change the sunset, so that's what that does. Lines 1.13 through 2 is a clarification to the military pay subtraction to make it clear that this is, you either take the pay subtraction or you claim the credit. You don't get both of them. That's the way it was in Representative Detmer's bill. This is the provision that's in the underlying amendment did not pick that up, so that adds that back. Lines 2.16 to 5.6 is Representative David's bill that was heard last week on the apportionment of income for non-resident board members. Line 5.7 is a clarification that allows railroads and utilities to get the exemption under the state general tax, the $500,000 exemption that applies to all parcels. Line 5.8 to 5.9 is a change to the workforce housing TIF. The provision that we included in the author's amendment was the provision that was heard, Representative Fabian's provision that was heard in the division. We didn't realize that the Jobs Committee had added a separate amendment that essentially allows that TIF to be used not just for rental housing but also for manufactured housing and modular homes and that sort of thing that's not rental housing. So that adds that authorization in. There was also in the LMC TIF bill, there was a one division amendment, a two-word amendment that did not get picked up, and that's added. Lines 5.1 to 6.3 and then 6.21 to 7.8 adds a new sales tax vendor allowance. The committee heard vendor allowance bills. This is a variation on those that provides a 0.3% allowance on the first $10,000 of sales tax. Lines 6.14 to 6.2 modifies the sales tax exemption for bullion coins to remove the requirement that the sale be based on the spot market price. Line 7.9 to 7.18 is just there was an additional provision for the CNG motor fuels rate change. This makes it consistent with what federal law provides and with what the governor's tax bill provided. Line 7.9 to 7.27 is part of Representative Dean's tax credit bill. In his bill, he accelerated the repeal of the Minnesota Care provider taxes by a year. We just put in the income tax credit provisions and not the provider tax provisions, and it's now been told to us that we're supposed to be curing that in the tax bill as well, so that's added. Finally, the very last thing is the change in the budget reserve transfer to match what's in the budget resolution, because Ways and Means is not going to change that.
Okay, thank you. Questions? So, Mr. Michael, what were the items that we hadn't actually heard yet, lines 7.19 to 7.27? I don't think the committee heard a bill.
Correct. That was the 7.19 to 7.27 was part of Representative Dean's bill, and that was not heard in the tax committee.
Is there anything else that we did not have in some way, shape, or form that we've heard?
Mr. Chair, no. All of these other provisions are either technical corrections or additions of bills that have been heard.
And, Mr. Michael, the reason for the 7.19 to 7.27 is because with what HHS is doing for Minnesota Care kind of going away and becoming MNsure, that wouldn't be needed.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's part of the overall plan, and, of course, it is a tax provision to repeal this tax, and so I think the thinking is that it's more appropriately in the tax bill than the human services bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Michael. Okay, questions for members. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your amendment. I'm specifically looking at line 5.7, allowing railroad and utility property to receive a $500,000 CI exemption per county. What is the cost to the state of that? Because I assume that the spreadsheet that we received yesterday, I think, has not been updated to reflect this amendment.
Ms. Dalton? or Mr. Hines? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, Steve Hines from House Research. Representative Dabney, I believe those costs were already included in the original language. We just weren't sure the database I was using to develop the numbers had that property in it or not, and we found out that it did. So it already is reflected in the there's no change to the spreadsheet. That those properties should have been included. They just weren't in the bill language, but they'd been included in the modeling.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hines. I think I'm still trying to get my brain wrapped around then how much this costs. Would it be for the each railroad operating in each county, each gets a $500,000 exemption, and each utility operating in each county gets a $500,000 exemption. So if you have two or three railroads operating in a county, that's a three railroads, that's a $1.5 million exemption. Am I understanding the proposal correctly?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Remembering that it's basically 1% of value is the state tax, so $1.5 million is only, what, $15,000 of tax. The database I had seemed to suggest that there was roughly $6 million a year was in those two provisions of the railroad and the utility. Under this, when I was able to separate out that classification separately just to see what those numbers look like. And all utility property does not get this. Like the attached machinery, the generation machinery, the big power plants, they don't get this. It's just certain kinds of utility property that lend themselves to individual parcelization. So if they already get the $150,000 break on under current law on their first tier, then they get the $500,000 on the state CI break. But if they're right now just classed as a one big entity that's all at the 2%, they would not qualify for this $500,000 break.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines. So the 500,000 is the exclusion, the valuation exclusion per parcel, the or per railroad or utility per county. The 6 million is the cost to the state of that provision. Can you differentiate the both the valuation exclusion for railroads from the valuation exclusion for utilities, and then the cost to the state in that exclusion from railroads and that exclusion from utilities for me?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I believe I can do that. I think the more appropriate solution would be to say that if we did not include this technical change, then we should probably have changed the bill to grant a the bill was already reduced assuming that property was in it. The state general was already reduced assuming that property was getting it, so we could raise it back up. But I could go pull out those numbers and see what they actually are.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines, I'd appreciate that because I'm not sure in this bill we're raising the state general levy back up. Fair guess, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hines?
No, I think that's for you.
Oh.
Are you going to raise the state general levy in this bill?
I have no clue. Mr. Michael? What am I doing?
Mr. Chairman, the author's amendment makes the bill consistent with the levy estimate that was in the underlying amendment.
Thank you.
So if you don't adopt this, then you would want to adjust the levy number.
Back up.
And I think Representative Dabney is correctly assuming that's not your intent. Yeah.
Chair Dabney, that's what I'm doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rescalso, at that point.
I'm trying to catch up here with the discussion around this, Mr. Chair, just got in. But I think Mr. Hines and I talked about this yesterday, but I think the intention is on what this – am I wrong in understanding that this amendment would – I mean, the original intent was to repeal all of the categories of the general tax for C&I and not to leave – stragglers out, so this includes those into the repeal as well. Is that right, Mr. Hines?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drozkowski, the phase out of the state general levy will affect all utility and railroad properties, yes, with or without this amendment. So this amendment is only related to the first, the exemption to the first 500,000, which comes in the first year, and this applies it to utility and railroad the same as it applies to other CI property, with the caveat that it's only one parcel per county per utility or per railroad.
Now I remember, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Dabney. Chair Lincheski and then Swidzinski. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author's amendment, the provider tax issue, of course, was not heard, and I know you were just taking testimony on a Simonson amendment. Would you consider later in the day, you know, because we just learned about it 5 minutes ago, taking testimony on the change to the provider tax? That's a $227 million provision that's never had a hearing.
I think we should do that right now. Let's do that right now. Or, Chair Lincheski?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we just learned about it a few minutes ago. I think it takes people a little while to drive here. So.
Okay, we could come back to it.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're aware of anybody, let's get them in. Yep. Okay. Thank you, Chair Lincheski. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be to staff. I had a constituent contact me about the section of 6.18 to 6.13, just on the bullion side. Wanted to make sure that from a junk... From a junk silver standpoint, they wanted to see if that exemption would cover that. That would be like formal U.S. coins, so like pre-64 stuff, if that would for sure capture that. And that, I think that's 90%, but yeah, anyway, so that's what they're...
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this should capture anything that is primarily a silver coin, but it by eliminating the spot market portion on coins, it does make, otherwise most coins would not actually apply or qualify.
President Swidzinski? Okay. Okay, and members, if we act on this amendment to get the shape of the bill in the shape that I'd like, we can come back, of course, to any provisions throughout the day. So with that being said, further questions for members on the author's amendment? If not, I'll renew my motion to add H0848A32 amendment, understanding we can come back and discuss any of the bill at any time. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Are there any other amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
Do you have, maybe it's not out yet, an A23 in front of you?
I do not recall seeing an A23. Do the pages have it, maybe? Or
perhaps.
Oh, it's there we go.
Here it comes.
Yeah, let's get that passed. I will go to that one next. And then, members, if you have some amendments, let's get them ready to get passed out so we can start taking a look at them.
Trust the nurse.
We'll just take a second to have members get the amendment so we can take a look at it here.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Simonson moves the H0848A23 amendment. Two-year amendment, Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And this is a provision that's cleaning up a special section of law that applies to City of Duluth sales tax. 2 years ago, we passed into law a 0.5% tax on food and beverage and a 0.5% tax on lodging that was dedicated towards revitalizing the western portion of the city that we call the St. Louis River Corridor. And in doing that, we created, I think, to the maximum of $18 million that would be used for bond payments to allow us to invest in this revitalization. We came back this year, Mr. Chair, you might remember, or maybe it was in the division, we had a bill that essentially established a western boundary of where these dollars could be expended. And this, Mr. Chair, is essentially getting the bill, your bill, in the same shape as the Senate version with respect to this provision by adding a northern boundary to include Skyline Parkway. So, in other words, we're tightening up the area where these dollars can be spent in Duluth because we sold it as a St. Louis River Corridor Improvement Program, and we want to make sure that those dollars are expended in that corridor.
So, Representative Simonson, your original bill included Lincoln Park area and kind of to the west, and then what you're saying here is you're going up the hill to Skyline Parkway?
The original bill, Mr. Chair, was at 34th Avenue West 2 years ago, which did not include Lincoln Park. We came back this year, amended it to 14th Avenue West, which includes Lincoln Park, and now we're just tightening up the northern, the up-the-hill boundary, if you will, to Skyline Parkway, which still includes Lincoln Park. Just excludes the area above Skyline Parkway.
Okay. Questions for members? Chair Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could have staff help describe this a little more, too. I think, Representative Simonson, this is an augmentation of the bill that's in the division report. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, correct.
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I believe that Representative Simonson actually described it accurately. The way the bill is written right now, the allowed area would go from the lake all the way to the city border on that side. By putting in Skyline, you're taking out some of the area above Skyline Drive that would otherwise be eligible for spending. So this, Representative Simonson's correct, this does actually tighten it. It moves the boundary from the city border down to Skyline Parkway.
Thank you.
In the city border, then, Representative Simonson would be touching Hermantown or bordering Hermantown?
On the north side, it borders with the city of Hermantown, correct.
Okay. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to Representative Simons. Kind of what percentage of the city would you say would be kind of being cut out of the mix because of this amendment? Just from a yeah.
Sure. Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Swinski. So the question is, well, essentially what I can maybe tell you is that if we pass the amendment, we're creating about a 30 to 35% square of the city where these dollars could be expended. If we don't pass this particular amendment, maybe that's closer to 45%. But keep in mind that we sold our constituents on this tax provision with the intent that they would be spent in this St. Louis River corridor. So we're just essentially defining this corridor.
The gentleman from Lyon. Representative Simonson, how far, when you go down from the Lincoln Park neighborhood that you're including, does it include more than Lincoln Park? Are you going further out?
Further east, Mr. Chair?
Further west.
No.
Mr. Chair, the easternmost boundary would be at 14th Avenue West in the waterfront, which is essentially where the what you might know as the port terminal is, let's say, in that area. And then it would go straight up the hill in a northerly fashion to Skyline Drive and then all the way west to the city limits, encompassing all of Lincoln Park.
Other questions for members? Anyone wish to testify for this provision or the concerns, or does the department have, Mr. Cummings? Department have any comments? Not at this time. Okay. With that, seeing no other questions, Representative Simons moves the 823 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Item next. Chairman Chesky.
Sure, I have an amendment that I think the pages have. Yes. That I'm offering as a bill, Mr. Chair. It was my House File 990. And thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Chair Drazkowski gave this hearing, but the hearing literally, and we can go back and remove the tape, was about a minute and a half because we were over time. So we were technically past the time the committee was supposed to adjourn, and then we powered through a hearing really fast, and it was over. And maybe I have that wrong. Maybe it was you, Mr. Chair Davids, but I can't recall for sure where it was heard, but the hearing was a minute and a half. So we really didn't have time to get into this, and you know, I thought I would appeal to members of this committee to understand this issue a little bit. And so, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 990 as an amendment.
Okay, Chair Lincheski moves House File 990 as an amendment, and staff can do all their numbers that they have to do accordingly.
Okay, so thank you.
To the amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, just so you understand this issue a little bit, and maybe members will learn about it, because most members aren't even aware of it. So I only offered two tax bills this year, and this is one of them. And you know, I was hoping this is a very small bill, and I'm bringing it forward for all the cities that are affected by this lodging tax issue. But you know, my city is one of them, and so the situation we've got, I'll just use Bloomington as an example, but it certainly applies to all kinds of other cities. I think many of you represent them. The situation on this issue is that Bloomington is being treated different than, say, Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I know members of this committee have heard me say this many times, that Bloomington has more hotels than Minneapolis and St. Paul combined. So we have the largest hospitality industry in the state, yet we are being disaffected in the tax code, disadvantaged in that our, you know, larger competitors, Minneapolis and St. Paul, again, we're bigger, but they're our sort of competitors for the hotel industry. They're getting a tax break that we're not. And many other cities are in the same situation. And the way it works is it depends how you book your hotel, if you do it as an online travel company or if you do it through the old-fashioned bricks-and-mortar way. So the way this all plays through, and I can ask Ms. Dalton to walk people through the detail if they want to hear about it more, is at the end of the day, the cities like Bloomington, Duluth, and I know I didn't ask Ms. Dalton to bring the list, and I should have. You know, maybe she can remember some, but it was like Brainerd and Bemidji. There's just a bunch of them. You know, we're getting less money to the general fund than our competitors. And so Minneapolis, for example, is getting more lodging taxes because the way the state law is written, and cities like Bloomington are not. And so, you know, I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want to ask Ms. Dalton about it further, but I guess I would ask you, Mr. Chair, first, or Chair Drazkowski, why your thoughts, what your thoughts were about why you didn't include this in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you very much. First of all, we will go to Ms. Dalton, and then, but I think we will need to take some testimony on this, because I do know there's some concerns about this provision. I'd like to hear what they are from interested parties. Chair Lincheski?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're going to take testimony on all the amendments, I wish I'd have known that. That's not typical, but I would like to get my city in, so I can withdraw this right now.
Okay.
Because then we'll have testimony against it, and the folks who care about it don't know that there's testimony taken today.
Okay. You know, I think, thanks for bringing that up. I don't think we will take testimony on this. We shouldn't be taking testimony on any of these. That's what yesterday was for. So, in fairness to Chair Lincheski, we can continue to work on this with member questions and Ms. Dalton. Let's go to Ms. Dalton. I'm glad you brought that up, Chair Lincheski. Okay. Let's go to Ms. Dalton, and we'll go to member questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, right now the state collects its sales tax on the service charge of travel intermediaries, so Travelocity, Orbitz, things like that. It also imposes its the local taxes that it collects directly, the local lodging taxes. Four of them are collected directly by the state, Bowabic, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I have to admit, I don't know what the fourth one is. Might be Rochester, but I'm not 100% certain of that. Anyway, for those four cities, those travel intermediaries are subject to those local lodging taxes as well. However, there is no provision that says if a local government is imposing a lodging tax and collecting it locally, that those travel intermediaries are subject to the tax on the full price. So what they do instead is that they pay the lodging tax on their kind of wholesale price on those rooms, and then they charge a higher fee to the person who is renting through them, and the fees are built in, so the person doesn't know that they aren't paying the full lodging fee.
Okay, now help me on Ms. Dalton or Mr. Michael. Was this provision in the policy technical, the department's technical bill?
No, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's. But Chair Lincheski?
Mr. Chair, my bill is not the same as what was being offered by the Department of Revenue.
How are
there's some similarities, but. You know, they're not identical. I think the argument in the 1.5 minute hearing was about clarification of past actions of the legislature. But you know, I think the department is trying to clarify something from before. That's not really my goal. My goal is equal treatment. So they're similar, but they're not quite the same. And so when we talked about the technical bill here, that was different.
Okay, member questions? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've tried to collect some notes on this, and maybe Ms. Dalton actually said this while I stepped out, but this would expand the lodging tax to accommodations intermediaries. Do we have a list of those, or did you iterate a list of those, Ms. Dalton, when I stepped out? And rental home property operators, travel consolidators, tour operators, and other person that facilitates the sale of lodging. This would expand 125 different lodging taxes around the state to that. Is that what we're doing here, Ms. Dalton?
Ms. Dalton, or is that in the technical bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski and Representative Lincheski, the language that's actually here is what was in the governor's proposal. There was an amendment to Representative Lincheski's bill that would have modified it somewhat. The definition of ancillary services and accommodation intermediaries is the definition that is in the general sales tax law for what we impose the general sales tax on. I know it's aimed at the online intermediaries, and I know that there was work when that definition was developed to exclude things like traditional travel agencies. But if there is somebody from the department who might want to comment further on kind of the negotiations that occurred previously in when we developed that actual definition of accommodations intermediary.
Well, we weren't going to be taking testimony here, so let's go to member questions.
So, Mr. Chair,
Draskowski, the floor, and then.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. So, what we are discerning here is that this is expanding the lodging tax in these 125 communities around the state, and we did hear this in the division. There was a heartburn amongst a large number of members I talked to after the hearing was had, which I wasn't in the room during the hearing, Representative Lancheski. So it's an expansion of it. The question is as to what extent and to which different types of businesses seems to be the discussion, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do we have a list of the 120 cities, and could we have someone read them? Just kidding. Chair Lancheski. Chair
Davenport.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Lancheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm actually surprised to hear Chair Draskowski say that. And, you know, I don't know what the heartburn was. It certainly must have happened in the hall because, like I said, the hearing was about a minute and a half. It started after the committee was supposed to be adjourned. And so neither I nor my city, in fact, some of my city testifiers didn't even get to testify. So, you know, I think the right thing would have been to have another hearing so that people could have talked about it. You know, particularly since... You know, as usually, you know, committee members and most committees kind of get, you know, some priority time to have their bills heard, and it's one of two I introduced. And I think the combined total of those two bills hearings was under 5 minutes. And so, you know, if there was some large heartburn, I wish that would have been shared with me. But what I can tell you is if folks don't think Bloomington should get this tax treatment, then let's remove it for the people who have it. I mean, if there's a problem that it's terrible tax policy, then why do some cities have it? I mean, it's just so Bowavik gets it, which I don't know what their hotel industry is like in Bowavik. I can only imagine, and I don't even know where Bowavik is. Quite frankly, I think it's an Iron Range. So, where is it?
Representative Moline, where's Bowavik?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lancheski, it is on the Iron Range. It's actually would be in Representative Dill's district, I believe, or Mesa. Not sure.
So Mr.
Range.
Chair, Mr. Chair, can Representative Moline tell us how many hotels are in Bowavik?
Representative Moline, how many hotels are in Bowavik?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lancheski, I'd guess two or three or maybe four.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I mean, I just hope members would be fair in their tax policy as they think about this. So, I think six are under construction in my city right now. Again, Bloomington has more hotels than Minneapolis and St. Paul combined. Yet we don't get the same treatment that Bowavik gets in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So, I think if the majority has a problem with treating this fairly, I mean, there's two ways to do it. You take it away from those cities, or you give it to everybody. And most of the cities who would get this equal treatment would be in your members' districts. And I do have the list. I can bring it later. And they're mostly greater Minnesota. So, you know, I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm befuddled as to why this didn't make it into the tax bill, but at this time, and I hope we can consider this further with you, Mr. Chair, as the day goes on and tomorrow, I'm going to withdraw the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lancheski, but I'm going to be asking some more questions if we go into recess or before the meeting tomorrow. But I know it's withdrawn, but just one quick question to Ms. Dalton. If this affects Bloomington, why do we keep hearing stories about it affecting 120 some other cities too? What are we doing here?
Mr. Chair, this amends the general local lodging tax law as well as all of the special laws. Bloomington's local lodging tax is generally imposed under special law, but there's 120 cities and small towns that impose it under the general law in 469.19. And so all of them would be affected as well.
Okay. Okay, this has been withdrawn at this time. Okay, the next amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Chesky.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Chair Anderson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I have the 826 amendment.
Okay, we have the 826 amendment. Staff will we get the amendment passed out or a page here. Okay, I think most everybody has the amendment. Representative Anderson moves the H0848826 amendment. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that we had an earlier conversation about in the Property Tax Division. It's dealing with the health-related costs that counties have experienced due to the different changes on health care in the state, Minnesota, and medical assistance in Minnesota Care. And so what this does is ask the Department of Revenue to check with each county, compile some information on how much of an additional cost our counties are experiencing due to the changes. We heard testimony in the Property Tax Division of several different counties having to hire additional staff and reallocate funds in order to address this issue, and I think it would be helpful for the legislature to get a better picture of the impact of this overall. And so that's what it does in a nutshell.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Yes. Questions from members? Representative Loeffler, then Dabney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, there's no question that there were some issues. There was not enough lead time provided to do all the complicated programming. And in Minnesota, though, we did two things at once. We created our exchange as well as attempting to update the computer technology that counties use for eligibility that, quite honestly, all of us should be embarrassed with because it is 1970s and 80s computer platform that has had a few minor updates in the 90s and maybe a minor adjustment in the 2000s. And the reality is right now that DHS cannot find enough consultants to come out of retirement because they haven't been teaching this programming for decades to even implement the law changes that we enact. And so we had two things kind of happening at the same time. We had MNsure as the access point to applying for, if you were eligible, Minnesota Care MA, but at the same time trying to upgrade a system that literally is based on 80s and 90s. Like we all, people at the counties will have color monitors. I don't think they sell black and white monitors anymore, or the green and black ones, but they actually will see green and black screens like, some of us are old enough to remember. And it takes about 18 months for an eligibility staff person to actually learn all the coding because it isn't at all like how a modern system would work. And so there have been definitely burdens imposed on counties with doing that. I just think it would be difficult for them to go back and recreate all of that and separate the two items. I'm sure they could make an attempt at some portion of the combined effort, but I'm not sure if you wanted a really accurate report, it would take a lot of effort. And I'm not sure, Representative Anderson, if your intent was to try and have them sort out those sort of things, what was related to getting onto MNsure and creating an account versus what was dealing with the other portions of the eligibility system.
Okay, thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, I just wonder if Representative Anderson would just be clear about what it is that she's trying to get to. Is it everything? It's updating the computer system and MNsure, or you want to try and have the county separate out MNsure itself, the establishing accounts, getting employees registered.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler. It is all of the above. Essentially, what we heard in testimony in the Property Tax Division is counties have been tracking how much this is costing them because they've had to make adjustments within their budgets to account for those additional costs. So I know that they have been analyzing how this has been impacting their budget, and at least for the counties that came to testify, they certainly had their ducks in a row and how much this was going to add to their burden as a county unit. And I just think that that would be helpful information for us at the legislature to have as we're moving forward making important decisions in this issue area.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I do think it's, you know, people are working to change these systems and update them. It might be more useful to say going forward as opposed to trying to recreate back to 2014, because that just puts one more administrative burden on the counties to try and recreate a fiscal year they've already closed out and moved on and trying to dust off the memory banks. But I'm also wondering why you have the report just due to the committees on taxes and not those with Health and Human Services, because this really is a Health and Human Services issue as much as anything.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler, because the chair of the tax committee is this is part of his committee. It's not that this would be mutually exclusive and that only the tax chair could have it and have witness to it. I am assuming that Representative or Chair Davids will certainly share that with the rest of the legislature, and the document will be made public to all of us at the legislature. So just because it says that it's going to be directly reported to the chair of taxes does not mean that that won't be shared with the rest of the body.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have any problem with trying to get some good information about how property taxes have been impacted by a whole variety. I'd love to have this committee spend a whole hearing talking about the impacts of human services on property taxes. But I wonder if you've had a chance, Representative Anderson, to talk to the counties and to find out how much work this would be and how prepared they are to doing that. And what their estimated costs would be.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler. In the Property Tax Division, we had a couple of different counties come and testify. There was some documentation, too, of counties that have already gone through this process and provided this information. Just to give you an example for your idea, Olmsted County said that they added 3.7 staff. And then Ramsey's has here 20. There's another Stearns County with 15, and it goes on. There's a couple of other examples too. So that was part of the committee process and property tax. So the counties are doing tracking of this issue because obviously, because it's a new expenditure for them, they have to find funds elsewhere to offset the costs that they've been experiencing. So I don't think it's going to be a heavy lift for them to be able to provide this information to the Commissioner of Revenue.
There's a Loeffler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to be obstructive. I'm just trying to understand what you're doing and to make sure that what we get is understandable and supportable in terms of, I think, the intent of looking at this in the tax committee. And, you know, the funding of counties is pretty complicated, and it continues to be even more so. But there's a combination of federal and state dollars. Is your intent and local dollars is to sort out that if since you're bringing this to the tax committee rather than Health and Human Services, I assume that your focus is more on the local expenses?
Chair Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, this is to figure out what the financial impact has been on the counties and how that's played a role in their property taxes. That's why the bill initially went to the Property Tax Division, and that's why this version of the bill is here, or this amendment is here in the Tax Committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the language is pretty general, and it probably won't get you exactly to where you want to go yet.
Thank you. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Loeffler, it won't get the legislature the information we need because it's only asking part of the question. Change is always
have expenses, but with the expansion of Minsure, we also saw a significant expansion in the number of people covered by health insurance. Mm-hmm. And our county, Hennepin County, saw a meaningful decrease in uncompensated care. So there were savings to the county through that, as well as, you know, costs associated with changing over to new systems. Representative Anderson, what's the fiscal note on this?
Chair Anderson asked.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davney, this is information that we're asking the Department of Revenue to obtain from the counties. And they, if there's any costs that they have in collecting this information, it would be for them to absorb.
Chair Davney?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, every little report we get includes that first sheet that pursuant to Minnesota statute, yada, 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 the cost of developing this this report was, and fills in an amount. Now, none of them are free. None of them have a fiscal cost of zero. They all cost something. There's staff time that you have to attribute, things like that. So, I again, what's the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair.
And do you have the fiscal note in your possession?
Representative Draskowski reminds me that the fiscal note on my bill was zero.
Mr. Davney?
Does staff have that? Because I've never seen one of zero on these things.
Maybe Ms. Schill could join us.
And Mr. Chair, have you requested a local impact note on this? Because this is directing costs onto the 87 counties across the state to, again, put staff time and research time and resource time into collecting this data and assessing it and then transmitting it over to the state. So have you requested a local impact note on the costs associated with this?
We have. And if Ms. Schill could help us out here.
Mr. Chair and members, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. This is a complicated issue. I first requested a fiscal note for this bill in February, and we received a fiscal note prior to the Property Tax Division's hearing on it. Since then, the fiscal note has been retracted and is in process. So I can't give you the accuracy of the first fiscal note release that we had before the committee, but it was a nominal amount for the biennium. It was $59,000 for admin cost, and that basically was from the Department of Revenue. There was also a response from the Department of Human Services on this. So at that time, without an update, that's how I can answer your question right now.
Mr. Chair,
I was never good at math, but 59,000 is not the same as zero in the math that I did learn.
Per month.
And I would imagine even under Common Core, 59,000 is not the same as zero. And retracted is not the same as zero. So we seem to, in fact, have a, at this point, we would prudently we would have to assume or we would have to account for at least a $59,000 expense. It might come out less, it might come out more, but it seems imprudent at best to go forward with a $59,000 cost that we're assuming will be taken care of by fairy dust. Your spreadsheet doesn't seem to include much fairy dust. Or a lot of it. I'm not sure when.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sure Representative Draskowski and Representative Anderson remember the revenue estimate, which did have zero in fiscal 16 and unknown costs for the years thereafter. So this was a combination of both revenue estimate and fiscal note. And so right now, what we could do is I could see upstairs what kind of update we might have, if that would please the committee.
Mr. Chair,
Chair Anderson, yes.
Representative Davney, when you passed the Minsure language, did you guys have a local impact note on that?
Chair Davney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that wasn't my work, so I can't speak to But Mr. Chair.
Chair Davney.
Local costs are local costs. What was done in the past is immaterial. You're imposing local costs on 87 counties. Whether we accounted for those costs in the past or not is immaterial. You're doing it right now. That's what matters. There's a fiscal cost to this proposal. We need to account for that. There's a local cost to this. We should account for that. The chair has indicated that he's asked for a local impact note. We should know what the costs are of what we're going to do rather than just make stuff up as we go along and make up numbers that we want. $59,000 is not the same as zero.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. However, you failed to recognize the fact that this change in our law is costing counties, not just in the past, but going forward as well. And I think that at the minimum, it's our responsibility to figure out what those costs are, if there are policy changes that we can make here at the state level to help make those changes. And I've got testimony after testimony of different counties that have expressed concern over the changes that were made and are asking for some kind of recognition here at the legislature that they are eating these costs. And I think that that would be helpful for this committee, as well as all the other committees here at the legislature, to get this information. I'm just asking for additional information. That's it.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Chair Deb.
Representative Anderson, your simple ask for additional information is going to cost the property taxpayers of this state $59,000 for the state and unknown amounts of money in 87 counties. We can wish that away. We can pretend it doesn't exist. We can justify that expense, but we can't make the expense disappear. $59,000 and zero are not the same thing.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson S.
And Representative, for the Hennepin County alone, they had to hire an additional 75 FTEs. So this is no small number. And I think at least to the citizens that we represent, we owe it to them that we look at this issue and figure out how much have we passed on to the counties and, you know, what can we do to rectify some of the problems that they're experiencing. And these are ongoing problems. This isn't something that's just in the past. It's going into the future. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Chair Dabney?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we also owe it to our taxpayers to be responsible and mature with the amendments we provide, which means recognizing that when there's costs attached to those amendments, there's costs attached to those amendments. And wishing that cost away doesn't make the cost disappear to the taxpayers of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Drazkowski and then Moline. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Schill. I remembered a zero very clearly with that discussion when we heard that in committee, and indeed it was the revenue note. And I'm curious, retraction of what was then a fiscal note for this, what we could expect. Maybe Michelle couldn't give us any more information on that, but I don't know that I've seen a retraction like that before, or what might have inspired that. So, Representative Dabney, no, it's not, going from zero to 59,000. I do remember a zero, and but apparently the fiscal note came out after that, and it looks like Michelle doesn't have anything else to tell us on that item. So, no, Michelle, if you don't have anything else, feel free to. So members, I support this provision. We heard this in property tax division. Some counties testified that these additional costs that have been accruing to counties because of the additional burdens of MNsure upon them were getting to be very burdensome and have been accumulating for up to 3 years. We can continue to allow our head to be stuck in the sand on this issue, or we can do something that's very prudent, like Representative Chair Anderson is bringing with this proposal, and be prudent overseers of the people's money. So I appreciate this amendment and support it fully.
And members, just for clarification, the revenue note and the local impact note were for House File 419, just for the record. Okay, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I guess I have a question about on line 1.9 of the amendment where you require the county employees and county staff to to compile information regarding the administration of Minnesota Care, and I'm just kind of wondering how that's relevant going forward, since the Republicans are planning on eliminating Minnesota Care, and in fact the chair's amendment that was just passed on to the bill eliminates the Minnesota Care provider tax. Minnesota Care, of course, is the insurance that provides coverage for the most low-income Minnesotans, entrepreneurs, farmers who can't afford to purchase private insurance. And so since the Republicans are proposing to eliminate Minnesota Care, I'm wondering why you're still going to require county staff to compile information on how much it costs to administer Minnesota Care through MnSure.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, because I'm not looking at just going forward. I'm also looking at what has happened up to this point. So this is a combination of getting information for us that will help us in making decisions. So,
cool. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, to look backwards like that, and I would imagine these county employees, talking about county costs, the county employees who help people with enrolling in medical assistance in Minnesota Care, the same county employees who are currently serving the most low-income Minnesotans who are, you know, probably managing crises in their personal and financial lives, and those workers are attempting to assist them right now. And now they're going to be, instead of helping those people, they're going to be taking their time away to look back at what they did in 2014 and be compiling information for you for this study that's then going to be reported to the tax chair. And it seems like compiling a lot of information that's not even going to be relevant, such as the Minnesota Care piece. So, you know, just thinking about the counties that I represent, St. Louis County and Itasca County, you know, we are in a slight economic downturn right now on the Iron Range, and unfortunately when that happens, people do turn to county services more, and now instead of being able to serve those people, you're going to have county employees compiling information for this study for stuff that happened in the past in 2014. I don't want my counties to have to absorb these kind of costs and to report back to the tax committee on it. I think we need to look on going forward on the best way to serve Minnesotans. So I would ask committee members to please recognize the costs that counties are going to have to incur in order to enact this, and I would ask committee members to please oppose this amendment. Thank you.
Chair Anderson, yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, as I mentioned to Representative Loeffler, we need this information. I think this will help us as being decision makers. And the counties have already been gathering this data because they've had to make adjustments within their county budgets to account for the additional burden that they've had. And there's been lots of different reports about some of the workload that counties have experienced because of the changes in law. In Sherburne County, the health official there said it's shifting its backlog, that the Department of Human Services is shifting its backlog of unprocessed paper applications. In another county, Stearns County, Stearns County is expecting it will need to process about 3,040 paper applications for MnSure in the next 14 months, or about 217 per month. So they've already been collecting this data. It's more of getting this information to us as legislators, as decision makers, and making sure that we have the information that we need to make sound policy decisions here at the state level.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've never seen this language before. I don't sit on property taxes or health and human services, which I assume this language would have been heard in that committee. I don't know if it was or not, but I would like some time to contact St. Louis and Itasca counties and present this language to them and see how much they think this is going to cost them, how much staff time they'll have to put into responding to this request. And I simply haven't had time to do that, having not seen this language before. So I would ask that we at least have time before we vote in order to contact our counties to ask what costs are associated with this.
Thank you, Mr. Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I've had a chance to think about this a little bit more, you know, I think if your intent is to help counties deal with unfunded mandates and understand how much that is, I think we can probably bring a whole lot of information to the table. The people that you're asking to do this are actually in the Health and Human Services bill going to be asked, because they're the eligibility staff, to step up and do a tremendous amount of new work working with a private contractor in which Chair Dean assumes that they're going to, you know, somehow come up with $300 million of savings. And it's the exact same people who are working on this. And while county, it's easy to off the top of your head say we added three new people to deal with a backlog, the reality is a lot of those people were also eligible, found out they were eligible for perhaps food support. And they may have gotten, you know, $20 a month now of food support as a result of our combined application. We tend to have, you know, people fill out one set of forms rather than multiple. And so it's not as simple as you think in terms of a financial worker processes accounts on the computer. And separating out all the different programs and MnSure separate from others is going to be more complicated, and I think that you have a chance to realize. In some counties, there may be some dedicated staff who were hired just for MnSure and who did outreach and a facilitation of helping people get through that system. In other counties, it's, you know, it's a multi-purpose financial worker, and they might, you know, be doing 20 minutes on this, and then they go switch and helping someone else, and they've just got a stack of it's not usually paper applications. They have a stack of workload backed up in their computer that they're just trying to process through. And so for some counties where they did actually add some additional personnel, I'm sure they were accurate in testifying on what that was, but 87 counties are very, very different, and I suspect that we'd have a real challenge for some counties. And counties, I think, really do try and do an accurate job. You're not asking for an off-the-top-of-your-head, you know, rough estimate. When they put things down in a report, they really try and do it right, you know, with going back and trying to do time studies and estimate what volume of applications came in through this door versus that door. You know, they all end up in the same desk on the same computer in many of the smaller communities. And so there really will be a local impact cost to this. And I think if you really want to help the counties, the way to help them is to increase county program aid and recognize the fact that they have growing demands from state action in bills passed in the past and definitely in the bills going through right now, and that we ought to recognize that in property tax relief through this committee.
Questions for members? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. As Mr. Chair, and as I review you know, normal practices on nonprofit organizations and other agencies and other groups, even small nonprofits that we might be involved with, when we implement a policy like this, which is fairly large, one of the things that if we want to be successful, we have to take time to evaluate what has happened in the past. In other words, we need to collect dollars, and we need to put dollars invested into that, because I don't know of any group or any policy that you want to make effective that you don't want to have some sort of evaluation at the end. I think this is just asking, you know, what is our cost? What has it been? How are we going to determine whether or not it's effective? And it's going to be helpful to the legislature because we're making some of the policies that impact the county. So for us to say, no, we don't want to look at the past, we just want to look to the future, really doesn't help us figure out how we help that future become better, because then we're just kicking the can down the road. And so it seems to me that this makes really the effect of helping us make better determination about the future. And what I found also interesting that I want to just remind you for the debate later on the floor is we've had some discussion around here that we don't want to look to the past, and so hope that that also relies onto our transportation bill later as well. So, thank you.
Questions for members? With that, Chair Anderson S. Renews her motion that we add moves the 826 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. Okay, amendment next. Chair Drazkowski has an amendment, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like I would move the A15-0503 amendment.
Okay, if you could start describing your amendment, we'll get the amendments passed out to all members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick had a bill before the division that attempted to bring together some disputes between counties and assessor groups and others about the qualifications for being an assessor, the accreditation or the certification around it. We heard the bill in division. It was clear that this issue was not ripe for us to move forward with a bill in the division report, so we did not have one in there. Since then, Representative Lewick has continued to work on this bill very diligently and has worked with the assessor groups to bring forward what I think represents a good compromise that offers some light at the end of the tunnel for this somewhat contentious issue. So this amendment, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Hines can help me out with it, but from lines 1.5 through 1.14 on the amendment make it clear that the county assessor who has the full accreditation has full ability to assess all property, including income-producing crop properties. And then paragraph B allows a county to hire an assessor who can appraise all but income-producing properties or all non-income-producing properties, which would allow, as I understand in those cases, for those counties to be able to, and there are examples where counties only have a very small handful of income-producing properties, would be able to contract out with a neighboring county or another assessor in order to do that. And that's the fix on this. Lines 1.20 through 1.22, Mr. Chair, make it clear that the Board of Commissioners in consultation then with the county assessor would have the ability to outline the qualifications and training requirements for assistant assessors. So that's the amendment, and I would encourage member support.
Any questions for members on the 0503 amendment? Chair Dabney.
Mr. Chair, maybe to staff, what's the definition of income-producing property? Well, how are we? What properties are we talking about here?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, income-producing property is defined by reference to, it's basically class 3A and 3B and 4A and 4C, except for seasonal rec property. So it's CI, it's apartments. I don't know if Mr. Hines wants to talk about this, but so it's essentially what you would think about it. It's commercial, industrial, and apartment rental property. Essentially, that's largely it. I'd have to go back. I'm not the main property tax person. I don't have all of those class letters burned into my memory to identify which of the things that may be excluding.
Mr. Chair,
that's Chair Dabney.
Yep. If you're asking for Mr. Hines to come up, I'm wondering about agricultural land that's obviously income producing, forest land that's obviously income producing. Income producing in the day-to-day use of that term and in the intent of the owners.
Okay, and Hines, Carolyn Chesky, we have a situation where I think your members, and not right now in Ways and Means, I'm trying to monitor this so I'm not playing games with either side here. So members, we may be called up, the Ways and Means Committee members, at some point. We'd go into a brief recess so that members from both sides of the aisle can get up there and vote whatever they need to do in Ways and Means. So we're going to be kind of monitoring that because I don't want to, you know, you were up there, you were down here. We want to make sure people get their votes for the record. So to the Dabney question, Mr. Hines,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the answer, truthfully, is I'm not positive myself. I've always assumed that that language is basically referring to commercial and industrial. I don't believe that they consider agricultural income producing because the valuation of ag land is not really done on an income producing basis. It's done on strictly a sales basis. It would be better to get if somebody from the assessor's organization or the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division could give you a more definitive answer. But I think when they refer to income producing, it's almost all just CI that they're talking about.
Chair Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hines.
Excuse me, Mr. Michael, to the Dabney question.
Just to enumerate, based on the statute, it does not include agriculture. I can tell you that to verify what Mr. Hines said. But it does apply to both Class 3 and Class 4, so the apartments, I believe, would be in there. It's a fairly complicated listing. It also includes certain parts of Class 5, which is the sort of the catch-all.
But
it would not include agriculture, and it would not include homes.
Mr. Chair, I won't ask Mr. Michael to read the listing in the statute for us. But to the amendment, Mr. Hines, it seems to be differentiating for basically CI property as we understand it. In paragraph A, you need to be an accredited assessor. For real property, not including income producing, you need to be a certified inspector. And to be an assistant, it's whatever. Can you review for me the distinction between accredited and certified, and which is more skilled and knowledgeable in our system of three or four rankings of assessors, please?
Mr.
Hines.
Chair, Dabney, I'm going to refer to Mr. Klayman, who's been doing a little research on this project, and I think he's got better information than I do on that.
Mr. Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. There are, and I don't know if I'll be able to list them off the top of my head, there are four levels of assessor accreditation. The statute as it exists now was the third level. That's the accredited Minnesota assessor. The level beyond that is, again, I can't remember the name of it off the top. I have a list of this, which I could actually go grab and provide to the committee if they'd like. The certified assessor, I believe that's the second level. So with respect to this particular amendment, the certified Minnesota assessor referenced in paragraph B on page 1, line 11, would be a lower level of assessor licensure than the Minnesota or accredited Minnesota assessor that's referenced on lines 1.8 and 1.9.
Chair Dabney.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, a couple of things come to mind. One, we had a lot of conversation in the division about how the Minnesota property tax system is just too darn complicated. And yet, the division report that was reported out Friday afternoon makes the property tax system more complicated. And now we've got an amendment from the chair to make it even more complicated. And now we're saying, if you're a homeowner, if you're a farmer, if you're a cabin owner, whatever. We don't require as much knowledge in the people who are going to assess your land for property taxes as we do if you're a business owner. And, Representative Marcourt, who chaired the division for 4 years in the past, is very articulate when he observes that property taxes are the only place where the government tells you what you're worth to determine the taxes. The government comes in and says your house is worth X and then determines how much taxes you pay. We don't do that with sales taxes. We don't do that with income taxes. We don't do that with any other tax. So the quality and knowledge and training of the folks who make that determination is key. And with this amendment, Chair Drazkowski is saying, well, the quality isn't that isn't as important as we thought it was. And it's going to lead to more of the very same problem that we attempted to solve 2 years ago, which was inconsistent assessment practices across the state. And we heard from forest landowners whose parcels crossed county lines, same parcel, two different counties, and were assessed differently based on which county was assessing their property. That sort of inconsistency drives property owners in Minnesota nuts and undermines their confidence that the system that assesses the valuation of their properties, whether it's farmland, we got the same complaints there, seasonal rec, homesteads, whatever it might be, drives those folks crazy, undermines the quality that they see, undermines their belief that the system is accurate and fair and valid. I'd ask members to vote against the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, this amendment really aims to get at an issue in the assessing community and in the community of counties, if that is such a thing. By the way, the Association of Minnesota Counties supports this as it's drafted going forward. But it gets at an issue that puts some counties, especially smaller rural counties, in a position where they are forced under the current law to hire the much more expensive assessors and really not need that level of accreditation that currently exists in law. So it, I think it gives counties a lot more flexibility in the ability to do the best they can to serve the people. And this is no more complicated for property owners whatsoever. This is only the discussions around what type of assessor that is in that particular county or is doing certain types of work will really be reserved for the county board and the assessor in those respective counties. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I've heard from my county as well that's just retention of staff and, a lot of our assessors in our rural areas are aging members of the community and the changing this and some of the demands that we're going to be placed upon them when it comes to continuing education has been a big concern of theirs. And I think Representative Lewick's amendment here, Bill, does a lot to help ease some of those concerns from rural counties. And I just want to appreciate and say thanks for the work that he's been doing on this subject. And thank you, Chair Drazkowski, for moving it forward.
Further discussion? Representative Petersburg.
Just a quick question in regards to this licensing accreditation versus just certified, and maybe for either one of you up there. Currently, I know that assessors are also engaged in regards to setting values for loans and other things, which limits whether or not people can actually buy a home or not. Do you know what level is required in order to get an assessment for a federal FMHA loan or others? Does it require accredited assessor, or can just certified do that?
Mr. Klayman? Mr. Hines?
Chair David, Representative Petersburg, the assessor's office would never be involved in that, to my knowledge. That would strictly be a case of an appraisal from an appraiser. They can use the county's valuation coming from the assessor, but the assessor would never get involved in value for a loan purpose.
Thank you for clarifying that clarifies that for me, and I apologize for that not making the distinction. So thank you.
Further discussion? Okay, so we have the A15-0503 amendment for floor. Seeing further discussion? Hearing none, all fairs say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Item next, and members, since we're going to try and work together here on taxes and ways and means to get people where they need to be, how many more amendments do we have? I mean, it's just kind of to get an idea. Representative Slocum, is it as cool as your zapping bill?
Almost.
Okay. Chair Drazkowski, Representative Lincheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, other than Representative Slocum, I don't believe we have any. We're just sort of waiting for the majority to get the bill in the order that they would like it.
Okay. So let's go to the two amendments, and we'll open up for discussion. Okay. Let's go to Chair Drazkowski, and then Representative Slocum. Chair Drazkowski, what amendment do you have?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A33 amendment.
Okay. Chair Drazkowski moves the A33 amendment. If we could get that passed out.
Mr. Chair, this amendment...
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment really could fully be considered a technical amendment. It is a result of a review of the House File 1707 section of the division report, which is the language that provides that when land is purchased by either legacy or the LCCMR dollars, that the property tax liability is paid for from those respective funds. And the department, Mr. Chair, on the eve of beginning our discussion on the property tax division report, issued kind of and I think they'll be doing this for your tax bill too, Mr. Chair, kind of a technical and administrative review of the division report, and this fully includes the concerns around timing that they had around that provision, and as I understand, fully adopts their recommendation. Both AMC and the Association of Townships are supportive.
Chair Drazkowski moves the H0848833 amendment. Discussion from members? With seeing or hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Item next, Slocum. Representative Slocum moves the A.
Whatever number you want to assign it.
Oh, is this a bill? Oh, okay, okay. Let's take a look at it here.
Well, it's, 1565 is the bill number. And I'll be very brief.
Okay, Representative Slocum moves an amendment, and the amendment will be the language of House File number 1565. I'll instruct staff to code things accordingly. Okay, we'll wait just a second here until we have this before us here.
Mr. Chair,
okay,
they have seen this bill. We've seen it in committee. So,
in division?
I think I could start here.
Present your amendment.
Okay. I would like it to be considered to be in the omnibus bill. And I think I wasn't as clear as maybe I should have been when presenting this bill. I want to make sure you understand the significance of this TIF district to Richfield. Richfield lost 40 homes and about 8 small businesses due to the airport expansion. And I walked around with a map of this TIF, which runs up and down Cedar Avenue. You may remember I walked around with the map of this TIF district. The airport expansion caused this, and the airport is a statewide resource, which we all use and we all benefit from. The north-south runway expansion of the airport caused the houses and businesses to be uninhabitable, not because of the noise of overhead planes, but because of what's called low-frequency noise, which is the rumble as the plane moves down the runway. Attention, please, on this bill. Anyway, it's the rumble as the plane moves down the runway. And it, nothing but trouble over here. And it causes vibration that literally loosens nails, boards, screws, the building becomes uninhabitable, not just with the noise overhead plane, but with this rumble and then the destruction, the destruction to the structure of the building. So the low frequency noise is really bad. The runway is right across Cedar Avenue. The homes we took, about 40 of them, it's all and about 8 small businesses. It's all vacant land now. This impacts my city's tax base, and it also requires maintenance costs to maintain these lots. They took and literally bulldozed one small neighborhood to build this runway. Richfield's a small first-ring suburb. It's not silk stocking. It's pretty much working class. No, it isn't. Come see. Come sit on my porch and see. It's made of hardworking Minnesotans that enjoy the urban small town feel of Richfield. And urban small town is how we're tagged. That's how we advertise ourselves. It's a great place to live. However, airport expansion has hurt my city pretty dramatically. I need this TIF extension badly. And I don't think I talked about the impact of the low frequency noise as much as I maybe should have. And I would really like this reconsidered and put in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Spolkin. To the amendment, we'll call it, Chair Draskowski and then McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, Representative Slocum, for bringing this, and thank you for your excellent presentation during division. She was and is a very good teacher. Let me tell you, she had her full attention and just reminded us of that here a little bit ago. And this was not included in the division report, not because of your presentation or the intention of the author or the quality of the work they're doing in Richfield or any of that. It was not included because of the development of precedent setting that we're starting to look at with these proposed expansions of the collection of the increment. And that's, there are, I am told, and maybe Mr. Michael can speak more on it, but I'm told that there are well over 100 communities that could be coming forward and the floodgates would break open and we'd have all kinds of expansion of these TIF district collection activities happening across the state. And we kept another bill out because of that too. And so that's the reason we didn't include it. And I don't know, and maybe Representative Lencheski, I don't know if I don't want to put you in a position, Representative Lencheski, but there's some of us that really don't want to see us continue to expand the scope of this TIF law in Minnesota, and this will do that. And so that's why it wasn't included. And members, I'd encourage us not to do this because there are a pile of communities that would want to come forward and do the very same thing and extend their district's increment collection time period as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the author. Was this my first initial reaction when I saw the bill and you were walking around with the map very graciously? Well, the airport was there first, of course, before development, so they had to deal with it. But I later found out, and if maybe this was another bill, correct me if I'm wrong, was this a new runway that was added after the development and the businesses were there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, this was a new runway, the north-south runway. New runway added to the airport. Airport expansion. And this is, I also want to speak to Representative Draskowski's comment. This is not anything new. And I want to tell you, I don't love TIF. I sure don't. In fact, I don't think TIF should be used unless it's used in a blighted area, which is what this area was when we had to take out a whole community of 40 homes. I'm sort of a purist on TIF. I think TIF is way overused. So you won't see me back with the TIF bill. But this is an extension of an existing TIF because of the downturn in the economy. Yes, I realize. But we vacated the land. It's just sitting there. and we need this extension to get some development going.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as a former mayor, I was a fan of TIF. Delano, we used it for blighted areas and for development.
Blighted areas, yes.
I see and understand your situation and continue to open and listen to the debate and decide on how I vote. But I must be perfectly honest, I have a sympathetic inkling here towards your particular bill.
Mr. Chair, was it the map going around that did it for you? No, TIF is a very useful development tool, but I believe it's overused right now in our cities. And I'm sort of a purist on it. If the area has is blighted and under, way under utilized, and the potential is there for improvement, then I like TIF. Or it's a possibility. Otherwise, I think it's way overused in the state. I agree with you. Kind of an undemocrat philosophy. But hey, but this is an extension of an existing TIF district.
Further discussion to the amendment. Chair Earhart.
I think, Mr. Chairman, that point has been made, but this is an extension, not an expansion. So. Representative Slocum said that two or three times, which is different than Chairman Duskowski was describing it. So I think that that's an acceptable thing. You were extending the time, not expanding the capacity or the volume or whatever.
Thank you, Chair. Earhart, Chair Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it might be useful if Mr. Michael would kind of remind us how some of this stuff works. Mr. Chair, this is an extension, and as I understand it, it's really the only time the legislature needs to get involved is if a community comes forward to extend these tools, if you will. As I understand it, if the district expired and there was blight, they'd still be able to do another TIF on their own. Mr. Michael, is that accurate or not?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Draskowski, the situation with this, since they've removed the city has, as I understand it, torn down the houses, the blight that allowed creation of the district is gone. So they would not be able to create another redevelopment district when this one decertifies. I think the general concern that was expressed is that part of the primary rationale for the extension for this district and the Coon Rapids bill, which was also in, is that the recession essentially made it difficult to do development in the 2008 to 2013 period, and there were a large number of TIF districts that were created in that period before the recession occurred. And that if you start using that as a rationale for granting extensions, that, then probably many more districts could come in and request, many more cities could come in and request extensions as well, which would hold more property off the tax rolls for a longer period of time.
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael.
Any further discussion? Okay, Representative Slocum renews her motion that as an amendment, the language in House File 1565 be amended to the Omnibus Tax Bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, item next. Are there any other amendments? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment. I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
And
let's. But you're first on the list, Representative Loeffler. I'd like to know if there's any more amendments. If there's any more amendments, if not, we'll get into member questions on the bill itself. And Chair Lincheski, we said we'd be voting by 2:30 tomorrow afternoon, and we are coming back in members tomorrow for sure for a. Legacy bill. I think it's the Chair Erdahl's bill, so we will be here. We've got a bit of time here. If we get it wrapped up on the discussion on the omnibus tax bill as amended, Would you prefer voting today, or did you want to hold off till tomorrow on the vote? Now, maybe I'm assuming things. Maybe we have a lot of discussion to go, but I think we're pretty good on time here. What would you prefer, Chair Lencheski?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Other than some, you know, questions and thoughts, I mean, I think we've been ready to vote for a long time already. So, whatever you prefer, but we're ready to vote on the bill.
Oh, okay. So let's have some final comments, then, if we could, and then let's have the vote on the bill. And we do meet tomorrow, members, on the Erdahl legacy bills. And that should be, are we going to have the same situation today where we don't know what we're doing? Yeah, okay. So we'll have to be very flexible because this is the caucus room of the DFL, and we certainly want them to have the time they need to caucus. So the situation will be fluid, and just kind of watch your emails to see exactly what we're doing. We could kind of have the same situation as we did today. And thank you for your flexibility on this. So with that, I'll go to Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, as you know, Health and Human Services was meeting at the same time yesterday, so I wasn't able to participate in some of the walkthrough and discussion activities yesterday. And so I appreciate the chance and the indulgence of the committee to make sure that I understand what's before us, since I and perhaps others had to be in other places in the room. And you know, one of the things that kind of surprised me, and a lot of the things in the bill we heard lots of hearings on. I mean, I think we heard like 8 different estate tax bills, and I'm not sure which of them you picked, but I'll learn that later. But one of the things that seemed new to me that I don't recall us ever hearing was this additional personal and dependent tax exemption. And so I just want to make sure that I understand quite how this works, since I didn't hear the walkthrough. And as I understand it, it basically starts with the federal tax exemption of $4,000 per person or dependent. And then you take a fourth of that, so that's $1,000 per person. And if the staff can interrupt me when I start veering off the course, that would be great, because I'm, you know, tax law is interesting, but it's hard sometimes to read the summaries and figure it out yourself after you sat through a lot of discussion of Health and Human Services. So you've got $1,000 per person. It doesn't matter your age, your income brackets, or whatever at that point. And then you multiply it times your exemptions, which would be your family size. So if you had like 4 people, that would be like $4,000. And then I just want to make sure that I'm right on what you do the next step, because everyone keeps talking about this $1,000 per person. And but then you multiply it times their tax rate. Is that correct, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, yes, to determine the actual reduction in the amount of tax, you would need to multiply it by the marginal tax rate. And, of course, that assumes that you have enough taxable income to use the full amount of the subtraction.
Okay, so
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then I'm going to assume that it's sort of like a typical family. I think our median income per household is somewhere around $50,000 to $55,000 a year. And if you had a couple with 2 kids, and so they're at that 7.05% tax bracket, when I do the math, I come up with $282 for that family. And does that sound like the right math, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, yes, that's the approximate tax benefit of the provision.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I was kind of looking at last night, and it kind of was like the incredible shrinking exemption, because I was kind of thinking it was that $1,000 per person, but it actually goes down to, even in a family of 4, about $70 a person. And that to me was a lot less tax benefit than I thought originally when I first heard the numbers, because I thought, wow, this is, you know, something that was going to be pretty big. And then, am I correct that this is not an ongoing part of our tax system? Is that correct, Mr. Michael?
That's Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, yes, it's in effect for 2 taxable years.
Representative Loeffler.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to have you go through all the other provisions that I missed yesterday because we heard those, I think, mostly in Tax Committee. But one thing that did intrigue me was now we have kind of a simple, if you actually still do it on paper, it's still, I think, pretty much a one-page form with a bunch of worksheets. And did we get an estimate from the Department of Revenue of how many pages it will be or how many additional worksheets when all these provisions go in?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, not to my knowledge. I have not seen that from the department yet, but they typically will do that for the conference committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really interested in looking forward to that because I remember in past years when I'd come up with some great ideas, I always had some ideas to go beyond the chickadee checkoff to a couple other checkoffs, and we always kind of hit this wall of like, no, you can't add a line because you add a line, you're on the next page. And, you know, maybe now that it's electronic, going to the next page and the next screen and the next screen and the next screen is okay, but I kind of think people kind of liked our more streamlined tax system, and it feels like we're going to have a lot more pages to think about as we go through. The other thing, Mr. Chair, and I was kind of disappointed at how little is in the tax bill about the new Minnesota CARE 2 program. Because it's a totally new state credit and that's never existed before. And we were asking a lot of questions last Friday in Health and Human Services about this and how it would work and what would be the state premium subsidy and what would the premiums then and the out-of-pocket costs be. And Chair Dean said it would all become clear when you see the provisions are put in the tax bill and implied that they were still working on it and that it would be, you know, tailored to the individuals, but that it would, we would know what it was when we saw what was in the tax bill. And so it was nice that it was at the beginning. Not that I wouldn't have paged through all 240 pages, but it's in the first article. And this new state credit, this major new effort, which is going to be the state contribution to health insurance under Minnesota CARE 2, is just $50 million a year. But it's not clear in the tax bill that you have before us what this does. Because unlike everything else in this bill where we get down to the weeds, I mean, kind of like we just did on the assessor discussion, and you know who qualifies and how much they get, and you get the runs, and you know what the tax incidence is and all that kind of good stuff, this just on page 29 says the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with others, are just going to figure it all out. And I not aware of any other new state tax credit that we would be asked to pass out of the tax committee with absolutely no understanding of what the benefit is and whether and being able to assess its impact on individual budgets. The proposal that we have, and I'm trying not to be totally negative to new things, we have to be open to new ideas. This replaces Minnesota CARE as we know it, which has existed for over two decades. It's evolved and changed over time, but it's proven pretty darn successful in keeping the working poor on ongoing health insurance and stabilizing their lives and keeping them working. And for those of you who don't serve on Health and Human Services, Representative McDonald has the pleasure of doing that with me. This is really the working poor. These are the people who are just above eligibility for medical assistance. If they're a single, it's $8 to $11 an hour. $8 to $11 an hour just gets you $16,000 to $22,000 a year. If you're married, it gets up a little bit higher, but I don't think you even begin to break $30,000 for two people. And so you're right on the edge. You're living paycheck to paycheck at $8 to $10 to $11 an hour. And what Minnesota CARE has as premiums right now is $50 or less for individuals. It's sliding fee. We kind of like that sliding fee. You pay more if you make $11 an hour versus $8. For families, it might go up to $100 a month. So it's very affordable. And it has very affordable out-of-pocket copays. Prescriptions are typically under $5. Office pay visits for people with mental health issues are zero. And you know what? It was designed that way. Because these people, if they start to get a little unstable with their health, it doesn't matter if they have MS, fibromyalgia, they have mental health issues, they have asthma that is tough to or epilepsy that's tough to regulate. We know that keeping them on their medications keeps their lives stable, keeps them paying, going to work every day, and paying their income taxes. And it'd be easy for some of these people with the health diagnoses they have to just say, I'm going to go on disability, and they could probably make it through. It's a complicated process. And then they're on medical assistance with the state paying for the health care with some federal partnership for the rest of their life. And but instead, because these people are proud and they want to work and they want to be self-sufficient, or they're just low-income people whose employer doesn't offer health insurance, they keep working. And they know that they're protected. If they slip on the ice and break a leg, they have a car accident, or heaven forbid, they get a really terrible diagnosis. And the current program that we have is about $400 million of the Healthcare Access Fund subsidizing those healthcare costs. And it's being replaced in this bill by $50 million in a subsidy. And I can't believe that we can take $400 million of healthcare stability and affordability and do it with $50 million. And so I'm really, really disappointed that I was really hoping that when it was going to be clear in the tax bill that with $2 billion we would see some big numbers here and some real benefit to the people who Minnesota Care has served. And instead, it's just a drop in the bucket, but it's got a gotcha on this as I read the bill. And that one, and that we didn't have any discussion of in the Health and Human Services Committee about how this would be implemented because it was all still being worked out. And if you look on page 5 of the bill, what we're asking the health carriers to do, our health plans, our nonprofit health plans, is that they're going to provide a premium advance to the qualified people under this new Minnesota Care 2. And so they're just going to kind of have this loan. And then the person who's get enrolled in Minnesota Care 2, they have to pay back the health plan April 15th of the following year. So they could be racking up. We don't have any tables. We don't have any projections. We have no idea. You know, they could be racking up, say, $200 a month. And April 15th, they've got a bill due of $2,400 to pay back this state premium tax credit. And $2,400, if it's that, maybe it's $3,600, maybe it's $2,000. We don't know. There's no projections. But it has to be given the cutbacks and this be pretty dramatic. They all of a sudden have this big bill due on April 15th. And while some of them might get a tax refund if they did their taxes early so they got it by the 15th, it probably wouldn't be anywhere near what this premium tax subsidy would be. And so I think what we're going to do is create a lot of bad debt on the books for the our nonprofit health plans. And a lot of collection agencies going after people who are working for $8 to $11 an hour collecting this. But since there's been no hearing on this particular proposal in Health and Human Services and how it would work, but we're being asked to vote on it, I'm wondering if our staff could provide us some more insight into how this might work, or if this is the limited information here is what we know.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I think the one thing that I would correct in the way you were describing this is that the the health plans are not going to, they're going to only advance the participant the amount of the tax credit. The way the system is envisioned is that the health plan will be notified by MNsure, or I assume by MNsure or the Department of Revenue, but probably by MNsure, of the dollar amount of the tax credit, and that's the amount that would be advanced. And so the individual would be required to pay on a monthly basis the full premium other than the tax credit. And so the total difference between the cost of Minnesota Care and the MNsure premium, they would be paying that on a monthly basis, and it's only the tax credit. And so then when they got their tax credit in the spring, it would be, you know, equal to that advance that was paid. Of course, if the individual, you know, had other tax liability that ate that up, they may not get a refund. And so in that point, there's a legit, or if they're tax refund is intercepted because they have some other debt that they owe, there might, you know, there definitely will be instances when they would not get a refund that's equal to the credit that they were entitled to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Michael, do we have any information on what the size of that state premium subsidy would be on a monthly basis and how that would build up, or what kind of dollar ranges we're looking at for that, so we'd know how much people are to advance, are going to owe come April 15th, several months after they've gotten the coverage?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I do not know that, and I know that it's envisioned that the amounts will differ depending upon which of the two tiers of the coverage that you're currently in.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and, you know, sometimes people lose patience with the level of detail that we go into here, and even more they lose patience with the level of detail we go into in Health and Human Services, where we have, you know, typically hundreds of pages of pretty complicated sort of stuff, but we usually know what we're asking of the taxpayer and what we're asking them, what we're offering them in a new provision, and I care about these people. I think everyone does. This program serves, you know, over 100,000 people throughout the state. They are primarily in Greater Minnesota, because Greater Minnesota, unfortunately, has lower pay scales and more small employers who aren't able to offer health insurance to their workers. Disproportionately, the Minnesota Care enrollee is someone over 50 who works in retail. It's the guy who sells you your gas or who stocks the shelves at Walmart or Target. It's, you know, the ordinary people who go to work. Some of them, you know, work part-time because their health issues say they can only work part-time, but that's not necessarily true of the majority of Minnesota Care. But we're being asked to vote in this bill on taking away a very stable, predictable system that has worked for two decades for them and kept them and their family members and their children healthy and met their needs, got them prescriptions. Prescriptions are amazing in healthcare. I know someone who on Minnesota Care got dropped out because a car repair meant he didn't make his payment 1 month, got there late. He didn't have a $150 asthma inhaler and has very difficult to maintain asthma. He was admitted into the emergency room, spent 6 days, and the doctor said, "We almost didn't pull you out of it." And it was all for $150. Of course, that person dropped onto our safety net, medical assistance. We picked up half of that tax bill, or the medical assistance bill. But that person almost lost their life because they didn't have a $150 inhaler. And yet that's the kind of people who are in this program. And I would not be willing to vote for $50 million a year replacing a revenue source that we have right now that grows with medical inflation. There were more actuaries, I think every actuary in the whole state was involved when Minnesota Care was put together in the first year. It spent 22 hours just in the Senate Finance Committee with actuarial testimony. I mean, this is something that's proven. And now we've got a program that we're going to experiment with these people, and it's only $50 million a year, a flat amount, so the actual subsidy has to go down year by year. And we can't even be told what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be, what the subsidy they're going to owe April 15th, 4 months after a year of coverage is going to be. And we don't know what coverage they're going to get. We don't know what their copays are. We don't know what their prescription costs are going to be. We don't know whether it'll cover emergency rooms without a copay. We have no idea what their mental health coverage will be. I'm just amazed that in a bill that's as detailed as this and as detailed the bill that we had in Health and Human Services, we're putting at risk the health care of over 100,000 people in the state of Minnesota, and we can't even answer their basic questions about what will it cost, what will it cover, and how much help will I get. And to me, that's kind of the basics of how you write a bill. Who does this affect? How does it benefit them? What are the obligations they have, and how much does it cost? And what is the state participation? And the only thing that this thing answers is what is the state participation? $50 million a year. I'm just amazed and so disappointed, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I have Representative Lencheski next, but I think what we'll do is I think I'd like to have you wrap it up for your side, then I'll have a quick summary I'll summarize it quickly. So I'd like to have all other members first, if that's okay, Chair Lencheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, are you saying that you... Okay, maybe an understanding. So, you know, our members have all been here. I know most of your members are not here, but they do have still questions and things to say about the bill before we vote. So are you suggesting that not happen?
Oh, no. No. What I'm saying is you're next on my list, but I'd like to go to other members first because I'd like you to be last.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, I do want to come back, but I do have questions still. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one item is on the spreadsheet. I'd just like to make a request of you, Mr. Chair, and you'll do it or not. But Representative Draskowski's spreadsheet lists the property, the local option sales tax changes, and in the full bill now there's another significant one in transportation, and it's not on the spreadsheet, so I'm hoping you'll consider adding, for transparency, the new local option sales tax diversion that's in the taking the money from the five counties who are currently paying taxes for transit and shifting it instead to new counties, and that is in a provision that Representative Knobloch has, and it was added in this bill, and we've never had testimony on that either. But you know, my feeling is that because we're going to, you know, have the people who live in Representative Anderson's county and mine and Representative Bloom's and others pay taxes for other counties, I think that should be added on our spreadsheet.
Chair Lencheski, is that the one that we had testimony on yesterday from Commissioner McLaughlin?
Yes.
Okay, so we have had testimony on that. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, we did have testimony, but we didn't have a hearing on that. And I do not believe there was a hearing in property taxes either. It was talked about in transportation, and then because it was a tax provision, it made it here, but there was no hearing in either tax committee on that provision.
Wasn't. Well, we're having a hearing right now on it, so let's hear it. And Chair Lencheski, is that the provision that was in the jobs bill that we took out as it came from taxes?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was in the transportation bill.
What provision is that?
And it was Representative Knobloch, and he was taking, you know, and the point I made there is Representative Knobloch, sort of like if he had a St. Cloud sales tax, and instead we used the money to buy a bridge in Albert Lea, that's what Representative Knobloch was doing. He was taking Representative Anderson's constituents' taxes and mine and five of the metro counties, and instead giving the money to other counties, and that's now in the tax bill.
Okay.
Well, Representative Knobloch, I know, is in his own committee, so he...
Maybe we need Ms. Schill to, as far as, why is that not showing up on the spreadsheets?
Well, it's a local option sales tax. And Mr. Chair, the local option sales taxes don't cost anything either, and they're on the spreadsheet. They're zeros, and this would be a zero on the state spreadsheet, but it's absolutely a new change in local option sales tax policy.
Ms. Schill?
Mr. Chair and members, conferring with Ms. Templin, this is a provision that came from the transportation bill, so we will confer with Mr. Lee and make an adjustment to the spreadsheet accordingly. But it would go under the local option sales tax section, would have no state fund impact, but we will make sure that we get it recorded appropriately.
Okay, thank you. Chair Lanchesky?
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Chair, and you know, I appreciate that because I think the legislators here on both sides of the table who represent those counties, you know, if they don't understand it, they will eventually, that their constituents are now going to pay sales taxes on every purchase they make for things that was never intended in law and are going to now subsidize new counties. So, you know, I hope the majority will reconsider that because there's many members in your caucus who, when they understand a little better, I think are going to not like that. And so that might be, probably it won't have success removing it here, but so I'm not offering an amendment on that, but I hope you'll think about that. And you know, then Mr. Chair, just a few comments, and I would like to make a few closing comments, but I do want to just bring a few things up before, you know, I hope your members can can tolerate, you know, our thoughts on this because we're really saving hours and hours and hours by not doing amendments. So, there are a number of concerns, I think, overall for me in the bill, and I can't speak for others, they'll speak for themselves, but, you know, I wish Chair Loon was in the room because I was walking through the bill, and there's so many new tax expenditures, and I know people like to call them tax cuts, but they're actually just hidden spending. There is about $1.4 billion is how I added up of new spending. Now, you can call it a tax cut because if you're the lucky guy who gets it, it's a tax cut to you, but it's new spending for everyone else. And so if you're not an angel investor, if you don't earn $258,000 a year and qualify as an angel investor, you know, then it's spending for you because you get to, pay for that subsidy in the state budget. But if you're the lucky, you know, angel investor, you get the tax cut. But most of these, you know, for members who've served on this committee a long time, know these are tax expenditures, they're new spending programs, and they're about half the bill. But, you know, Chair Loon isn't here, but I was adding up just the new spending in this bill for education, and I could identify $484 million over the forecast window, which I think would be better personally used to give Chair Loon a better target. She has $156 million in a $2 billion surplus, and instead she could have another $484 million if we didn't pass this bill. Similarly, Representative Schumacher, I don't know what his target was, and Representative Dean, I had heard Health and Human Services had a minus target, but in this bill there's $816 million in the forecast window of new spending in that area that are instead tax expenditures hidden in the tax code that could instead be given in the budgeting process to those chairs to not have to make the, you know, choices they're having to make. I know the jobs bill, this bill alone holds $318 million in jobs spending programs, tax expenditures. And I don't know what the target was for the jobs bill, but this bill in the forecast window that you can just look on the spreadsheet and count them up is $318 million that could have been given to that committee. But, you know, that certainly is the choice of the majority. And so, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But Mr. Chair, a concern I have is I asked Fiscal, and I've written all over it, or I could hand it out, but later I could share this. I asked the nonpartisan staff yesterday to see if they could price out the items that are not being paid for in the bill but are cited in the bill, or they're only paid for initially. And then they continue on out of the forecast window so you can't see the full cost. So in the general fund, the bill is being presented as a $2 billion tax cut, but in the general fund, by the time it's fully phased in, it's $6.8 billion with no way to pay for it. So, you know, I'm happy to have anybody take this and refute it, but I just want to walk through a few of them. So the estate tax shows up as $19.5 million in year one and then $41 million in year two, but by the time it's fully phased in, it costs $343 million. So I just think members should know before they vote to change the estate tax. It isn't $19.5 million in the first year and $41 million in the second year, it's actually $343 million when it's phased in. Similarly, the new markets tax credit, which on the spread on the forecast window says zero, and you can look on it on the spreadsheet yourself, it has 4 years at zero. It actually costs in 2020 and 2021 and 2022 and 20, you have to keep going way out in the window to get the real cost. You know, you're talking $97.5 million for a provision that shows up as zero. So, I mean, this is, in my estimation, members, before you vote for this bill, you should know the real cost, that much of these tax cuts are being pushed out into the future. And they're, if they had to be in this spreadsheet, we couldn't pass this bill because it would violate the budget resolution. It would put you in record deficit spending. The property tax phase out over the course of that, which takes a while to get there, and that's Representative Drazkowski and Hertas's premier piece in the property tax division, which is, you know, a huge tax cut to businesses. And I know people have been framing this as sort of, you know, these kinds of tax cuts versus corporate tax cuts, but you have to look at the full cost. So the overwhelming biggest tax cuts in the bill are for corporations. The price tag of that provision, when fully phased in, is $4.9 billion, $4.978. And these are nonpartisan numbers, so it's about $5 billion, that one provision, $5 billion, when you pass that bill. And so for people to say there's more middle-class tax cuts than corporate tax cuts, you have to look at what the full phase-in costs. In fact, the one set of, you know, I think people could say are middle-class tax cuts, that's just a, you know, like a drop in the bucket. It's 2 years, and as Representative Loeffler walked through the bill, you can figure out pretty quickly that the average single person is really getting $50 for 2 years, and the average married person with a couple of kids is maybe getting $240 for 2 years. That's the middle class tax cut. So it's like kind of this puny little scrawny tax cut that goes away really quick versus billions. And again, it's $6.8 billion in the tails for the tax bill when they're fully phased in. Additionally, there's some new non-general fund tax cuts in the bill, like the provider tax and others that we have just seen by today's amendment. And so, you know, I was trying to add up what are the tax provisions that we haven't even heard as bills, and those alone are almost $1 billion. It didn't even get a hearing. So the exemption and dependent change, the $100 million premium over the binding that Representative Loeffler just walked through, the $227 million in the provider tax, and Representative Knobloch's taking money from five metro counties and giving it to others, those provisions are about $1 billion, none of which even had a hearing. So, you know, I think members should be a little concerned about that. I think overall, when you know that the real price tag of this bill is actually seven, when you add the general fund tax cuts and the non-general fund tax cuts, it's over $7 billion. That's what's really happening. So we would need a $7 billion surplus for this bill to balance if we had to pay for it responsibly without gimmicks. I think if members, you know, want to vote for a $7 billion tax cut that isn't paid for and put us into deficit, that's fine. Members can do that. They just need to be honest and know what the real costs are of this bill. The CI is particularly troubling to me. I know it's a top priority for the majority, or it wouldn't be the most expensive thing in the bill. I mean, that is the $5 billion tax cut. And the reason it's troubling to me is, you know, it really, in my estimation, if I was going to come up with business tax cuts, it would be kind of last on the list. It really is not. It might be in the long term a progressive move because it is a regressive tax, but in the short term, it's not. It's actually a very regressive move because it's mostly just going to go to the owners of these businesses. And I know that I was trying, Chair Davids, to listen to your press conference today, and I didn't get it all the way done, but I was watching it on my phone, and I heard, I think it was Chair Drazkowski, in which he was here, saying that, you know, the biggest amount of that is to small businesses, and that's absolutely not accurate. Members, that $5 billion tax cut is mostly for big business, and it's mostly in the metro. And There's a whole bunch of it in my district. So the way it's set to phase in, where you first give the initial value to the small businesses, I guess you could say in year one. But the total price tag of that bill over the phase in being $5 billion on, you know, out of the forecast window here, is overwhelmingly going to go to the largest corporations in Minnesota, and they may not be people who live in Minnesota. I mean, so think about how this works. So I asked for Hennepin County's top CI property taxpayers, and Hennepin County, I think everyone knows, is the wealthiest county in the state. Under all the formulas, it's the only county in the metro that is a net loser in fiscal disparities. It has the wealthiest large giving cities, and so I just got this sheet and it just ranks, and I don't even have all the pages, but I started with number one, and it shows who pays the state CI tax, and number one is the Mall of America, and how would that work in? So, and that's in my district, and I still oppose this bill. So how that works is the owner of the Mall of America just gets a massive check. I mean, don't be fooled that this is something for the barber shop in the small town. I mean, that's there too, but as a percentage of the tax cut, when this is fully phased out, it's overwhelmingly a big business tax cut, and it's not to get new businesses to come here. It's not to hire more people. It's not to do something to grow the economy. It's simply to say, if you're here, you get a tax cut. I would direct those resources to getting a new business here, but, that's just a different philosophy. So I was kind of just looking at some of these, and again, members should know who gets these tax cuts. I mean, just in Hennepin, the top 20 who would get the biggest checks in the state in this bill are the owners are from, number two is from Hallandale Beach, Florida. Don't know where that is. Number four is from Bethesda, Maryland. Number five is from Atlanta, Georgia. Three, four, five of them are Chicago. Dallas is in there. Indianapolis. So, just know when you're going to hand out this tax cut who you're giving it to. It's for a bunch of large corporations, owners who own these properties. So if you know the name of the owner of the IDS building, that's who's going to get a really big check. And just, be clear, these are the choices people are making. So, I kept looking. In the top 25, we've got Germany. Just getting in the top 50, you get all over the country and all over the world is who's going to get these tax cuts. So, if people wish to, portray it as that this is somehow a mom-and-pop small business tax cut, I challenge you to spend a little time on that, because that's not what's going on here. As you phase it in, the first thing that happens is the first $500,000 of value is exempt. And so what that means, and I also heard this in the press conference, and this was not an accurate statement, it said that the littlest guy gets the most. So that is not right. I mean, this bill costs billions and billions of dollars. And if you think the small business owners in your districts are the ones going to get those large, tax cuts, I think you need to do a little more homework on the bill. So I can provide this to anybody who'd like to see who the winners are. Number nine is the Hilton Hotels. I mean, I don't know if Paris Hilton needs a tax cut, but maybe. The Galleria Shopping Center and Edina. The list goes on, and it those are who would receive these tax cuts. So I just, I think that we've talked about choices this year, and this is about choices. I think the governor and Commissioner Bowerly, and in fact Paul Cummings was here all the time, Mr. Chair, and does a great job for this committee. But the executive branch, I think, Commissioner Bowerly was right on when she talked about that the size of this tax bill is crowding out other spending. For every dollar of tax cuts, for every dollar of education funding, there's $14 in tax cuts. And that is choices. I mean, there is no question there's a difference between the two groups around, this table. I have already stated, I think there's irresponsibility here when you don't pay for things out into the future. It feels like a little bit of a bait and switch. And I think it's sort of an anti-reform bill. Representative Loeffler walked through, a number of these provisions. And we had people, not you, Mr. Chair, but I know Chair Drazkowski, again, I wish he was here. He said he wanted to make things simpler and less complicated and more transparent, and actually the tax code is now significantly more complicated. There'll be all the need for far more new things on the forms. The property tax system got a lot less transparent, and it's sort of the reverse of tax reform. So it's like bring in the tax expenditures, make things more cloudy, come up with more sheets for filing your taxes, and I think that part is a little bit disappointing. I also think the whole transportation funding piece in here to me is a gimmick. It's saying, let's carve out $400 million in taxes that go to other things right now and move them over to Chair Kelly so he can have a bill that doesn't raise taxes. So I get the political appeal of that. I just think it's, again, a budgetary gimmick that will cause problems in the future. And I think, thankfully, I think the Senate and the governor will ensure those kind of things won't take place. There are all kinds of provisions within the bill that I have concerns about, but I rather than going through them one by one, I just think there's value in members thinking high level. And, I know that around here, all kinds of members won the lottery. And, Mr. Chair, you've been very fair. You've got all kinds of members' bills in here. And, all kinds of interests at the Capitol kind of won the lottery, and they have all this stuff here. But all of that is not necessary in that you could instead give us all an income tax cut or give us all a state sales tax cut or, cut the corporate rate or get rid of the fourth tier. Instead, there's all this new spending going on, all these new tax expenditures going on, shifts and gimmicks off to transportation, all kinds of things we're not paying for in the future. And then sort of the premier thing the bill's being sold on, in my estimation, is something that appears to have been a last-minute idea because it never even had a hearing and, in fact, will only last a short period of time, will disappear. And so, it's unclear to me where we're going. I took you really seriously, Mr. Chair, and, I should say I think you've done a really excellent job chairing this committee and hearing from everybody and trying to, hear all sides and listen to the bills, and I think that's been a lot of fun this year. But I do think while there are pieces in the bill that kind of are, for different members and different interests around here, I think in the big picture it is not in any way something that I could define as a bipartisan bill. It's the size of the $2 billion for corporate tax cuts crowds out K-12, it crowds out health and human services, it crowds out higher ed, and, I think, Mr. Chair, you have said a number of things that you want to get a bill that's signed, and I believe you on that. I know how that goes, and having had some bills vetoed by Governor Plenty, I can relate to, and you've had some vetoed by Governor Dayton, and I actually had quite a few signed by Governor Plenty, and I hear what you want to do. I think we know this is not going to be it, and you've acknowledged that yourself, that this bill is not going to be the final bill, and I think that's true. But I think we're just so incredibly far apart. When the governor is bringing in a bill in tax cuts that's less than a tenth of this size, and the Senate is just slightly different than the governor, I think there's a long row to hoe here in the next 3.5 weeks. So, I'll just say again, I think the majority has, under the leadership of Chair Davids, has been very fair, and it's been a very good year, and we've done a lot of work, looked at a lot of things, even though there's some disappointments here. I will say the minority stands ready to help you get a bill that the governor can sign. I think we have a little insight to that. I think we probably know the governor a little bit better than maybe our side of the aisle, and work with him pretty closely, and very proud he's our governor and have been very supportive of his vision for Minnesota. And so, as we go forward, I hope you'll take us up on the offer to provide assistance in getting you that signed tax bill in the next 3.5 weeks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lencheski. Now, members, as far as, and I want to be very clear on the items that we've gone over that were not heard in bill form, they are being heard now because as we move this bill forward, we have heard the bill. And the amendments. So with that, members, what I'd like to do is go back to member questions, and then we will have a wrap-up by Chair Lencheski, and then myself. And, you know, Chair Lencheski, you say that the governor and this bill are so far apart, I can just feel that we're getting closer. I can just feel it. And members, we're dealt the hands we're dealt. We play with the cards that we have. And my numbers, as you know, were $2 billion. And we put the bill together in that fashion. We also know, and I'm a realist, and when I say that I want a bill signed by the governor, that's in all seriousness. That's my goal, and yeah, we're a little ways off right now, but I think we can get there. And so, with that being said, there's going to be some more numbers when this bill passes out of committee and it passes through Ways and Means and through the House floor. Then we go to this thing called the Conference Committee, and two gentlemen, as I said before, Speaker Dowd and Leader Bach, will give me new numbers. And when I get those new numbers, we will be redesigning this. So is this the way the final bill is going to be? No. I think everybody around this table knows that. But playing with the cards I was dealt, this is where we're at. And I'm a realist that in working with the governor's office, the department, and members of the House and Senate Majority Minority Caucuses, we will be hopefully getting to the point where the governor, where our governor can sign a bill. So I have Representative Moline.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I'll direct my questions towards Mr. Michael. I just want to be sure I understand the Article 4, the estate taxes provision that's in the bill. We did hear several estate taxes bills in this committee, and it looks like you've decided to fully match up with the federal $5 million estate exclusion. And so I'm just wondering, under current law, what percentage of estates actually pay the estate tax, and how many real taxpayers that is, how many actual taxpayers, and then under the current proposal, how many will be left to pay the estate tax?
Mr. Michael? I believe this is the Earhart provision we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moline, I unfortunately did not bring my revenue estimate for the bill along, so I don't remember exactly. Cynthia may have it. But essentially, under current law, there less than 2% of decedents pay the estate tax. After the at the federal level, with the federal exemption, that percentage drops to less than 0.5%. I think it's somewhere in the range of 0.3 to 0.2%. The one of the revenue estimates had on it the numbers of estates that would be estimated to be paying tax after the federal exclusion is fully phased in, but I just can't remember exactly what that number was. But it's
Representative Moline. Maybe we could bring up Ms. Templin or Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering if Mr. Michael remembers how many actual taxpayers that is—a few hundred, a couple hundred. That is a few hundred, a couple hundred.
Yes. Mr. Michael. Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I have the revenue estimate for the proposal that is in the House omnibus bill, and the revenue estimate says under current law there are approximately 1,500 estates that file returns, estate tax returns, with about 800 of these owing the tax. About 300 estates claim the qualified small business and or farm property subtraction per year. And then fewer than 10 estates annually claim the maximum subtraction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then under the proposed changes, how many estates will pay?
Ms. Templin?
Roughly 60%. Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, looking at the detailed analysis for the revenue estimate, it looks like when the when the provisions are phased in, that roughly about 60% of the total population, it was about 1,500, will be filing returns when the proposal is fully phased in.
So that would be, what, around 800 left to pay, somewhere in there?
Ms. Temple?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the number you said, but it's around 800 estates would
right,
be left.
Right,
to
it'd
pay.
Be a little less,
but 600 to 700 estates. Will be left to pay the.
And I just, Mr. Chair, so I understand how it works. I mean, so under current law, we phased it into excluding up to $2 million estates in 2017. So you would only have to pay the estate above and beyond what's $2 million. And now under the language in the bill, you would only have to pay taxes on the estate that's worth more than $5 million. In 2017 when it's fully implemented. So you get the exclusion on the first $5 million of the estate, and then the taxation is after the $5 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moline, that's correct. And the federal exclusion amount is actually currently $5.4 million, and it's indexed for inflation.
Okay.
Mr. Michael, does this bill index for inflation?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does. Once it essentially conforms to the federal, as the federal exclusion amount goes up, the state exclusion amount will go up as well.
Under current law, do we at the state under current law at the state level, does that stop at $2 million, or does that keep going up?
Mr. Chairman, the current law phases up to $2 million and stays there. It's a dollar amount in statute that's not indexed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Moline.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just to go to comments then on, you know, that particular provision and just the bill overall, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, why that would be a priority of the Republican majority or the state of Minnesota. And Representative Lincheski went through the numbers. But after the five-year phase-in of exclusion, it's going to cost Minnesota over $340 million in breaks for estate taxes. And if currently only 1,500 estates pay taxes, and after this language is enacted, only about 600 estates will pay taxes. Basically, there's a $340 million tax break for 900 estates in Minnesota. That means 900 heirs of wealthy deceased people, dead people, because of course the person who accumulated that wealth in that estate is dead, and then their heirs inherit it, and about 900 estates, heirs, will get a $340 million tax break. That's about twice what Representative Loon is spending on early childhood through 12 education on almost a million pupils in Minnesota. So, you know, just thinking of priorities, when we're spending twice as much on 900 wealthy estates than we are on a million students in Minnesota, that certainly wouldn't be my priority. But I think the most perplexing and bizarre part about the whole thing is that we know that the Republican majority is willing to spend money. When the Democrats were in control of state government 2 years ago, we passed a $39.3 billion budget, and the Republican majority is actually proposing to spend more than that. I don't know that I have my numbers exactly accurate, because I know just yesterday the Ways and Means Committee actually voted to spend even more than was originally proposed. I think it's over $40 million right now. So we know the Republicans are willing to spend money, because they are in fact proposing to spend more money than Democrats did when we controlled state government. And so when you're willing to spend money, but that's the way that you're spending it, by giving tax breaks to 900 very wealthy estates, spending more on them than you are on almost a million pupils across the state of Minnesota, it's just a bit perplexing. I'm not sure that those sort of values are in line with the values of middle class and working class families across the state, Mr. Chair. And I did have one more question about the CI tax break that we've discussed, because I, you know, Representative Lincheski again went through the numbers of what that's going to eventually cost us after it's totally phased in. And it's over $4 billion, I think almost $5 billion after it's fully phased in. And I'm just wondering, I would assume, since we heard from Representative Loeffler's questions, that the tax breaks that middle-class families are going to get are limited to 2 years, then would it be the same is true for these property tax breaks for corporations? Are those limited to 2 years under the bill, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moline, the phase-in of the repeal of the state general tax is a permanent feature under the bill.
Representative Moline?
Okay, Mr. Chair, well, I guess, once again, there's very small tax breaks for middle-class families, about $70 a person maybe if they're lucky, and that's capped at 2 years, but there's over $5 billion worth of tax cuts basically indefinitely for corporations. It's obviously a values difference between the DFL and the Republicans, but I think that we just have to bring to light what's really in this bill and what it's really going to do to middle-class families and to education here in Minnesota, which is, again, prioritizing corporate interests over the interests of everyone else. So, Mr. Chair, I'm sure you won't be surprised to know that I can't support your bill here today. Thank you.
I am devastated, horrified, mortified, and terrified. But we'll see where we go from here. So thank you, Representative Emily. Thank you. Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just to begin with here, I want to also extend a sincere thank you to you for the way you have conducted this committee and for your willingness to listen to the minority. And I, for one, recognize the difficult task that you have been given. And I will also say, as my colleague, Representative Moline, has said, of course, I can't vote for your bill. Having said all of that, you know, we're at the point in this committee process where historically a friend of mine and yours, sitting here around this table, would get recognized and would say, you know, Mr. Chair and members of the majority, I know you can find it in your hearts. I know you can find it in your hearts to continue to work on this piece of legislation, to work to find a more balanced and just approach so that kids, the developmentally disabled, the mentally ill, poor people, people who live in, yes, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, get a better break in this period of unprecedented prosperity in this great state. And he would go on to say, I know, Mr. Chairman, that you're going to continue to work to give those people and groups throughout the state that I spoke of a better shake out of this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll close simply by saying your bill is just so far out of balance. It's un-Minnesotan, and please continue to be open to our suggestions from our side to make the bill better. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ansells. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate my colleagues on this side of the aisle observations and insights and comments regarding sections of this bill and the choices and the priorities that the Minnesota GOP members of this committee made in constructing this bill, and I guess maybe more importantly, as Representative Moline really went to, and also Representative Anzels, the choices your leadership made in $1 billion in tax cuts for businesses and $157 million for the children of the state in the K-12 committee as a fairly stark contrast. I was here in 2001 when there was a significant property tax reform, and it was touted from the rooftops. What a great thing this was. Speaker Sviggum came down from the speaker's podium and took the majority leader's spot on the floor and preached. He preached about what a great reform package that was. He didn't talk about how the economy was already softening, and we saw that going on at the time. And he didn't talk about how the property tax reform would raise property taxes for tens of thousands of Minnesotans, if not more. Tens of thousands just in Hennepin County, and I don't know how many thousands more across the state. And he didn't talk about how the changes in tax code would help push the state into a deficit that choices made in over the next decade, by and large, meant we refused to get out of. Not that we couldn't have, not that we shouldn't have, but we didn't want to. We refused to. Till finally 2 years ago, folks stood up and said, you know, enough of the gimmicks, enough of the shifts, enough of the games, enough of taking out the state budget deficit on the kids of the state, enough of taking the state budget deficit out on folks who need health care, enough of taking the state budget out on Main Street, Minnesota. We're actually going to balance the budget. But I want to focus a little bit more on the division report, the property tax provisions in the bill. And I'm struggling with that report because I'm trying to figure out whether I dislike the stuff that's in it more than I dislike the stuff that's not, or if I dislike the stuff that's not in it more than I dislike the stuff that's in it. I think it's the stuff that's not in it, but some of the stuff that's in it is troubling. And I'll focus mostly on the value of my vote being downgraded 90%. That the next time I go to the polls, if the provisions around reverse referendum in the property tax division were to go into law, my vote would be worth one-tenth of what it was the last time I went to vote. Because I would go and I would vote for my city council, I'd vote for my mayor, I'd vote for my county commissioner. But once they started actually making the decisions that the voters asked them to make, if 10% of the people in that local area government, whether they voted in the last election or not, decide, you know, we just don't like it, they can force a reverse referendum, undermine the election, undermine the value of my vote, and perversely encourage local units of government to never again cut their property tax levy. Never again will they want to cut their property tax levy if the reverse referendum portion goes into law. So my city 2 years ago cut their property tax levy. They won't do that again. Higher property taxes as a part of the division report. Higher property taxes for hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans with the deeply partisan decision to cut local government aid to just three cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Even though there are hundreds of cities across the state that get more local government aid per capita than those three cities. But somehow, the fact that those three cities have larger populations, are regional and statewide centers, and in fact, multi-state centers for business, culture, and other activities means they should get less aid, even as we ask more and more of those regional centers. So more property tax increases in the property tax division report. That's all troubling, but really what's not there is what's most disappointing. In the face of a $2 billion budget surplus, the GOP couldn't find a dime, not one dime, for property tax relief for Minnesota homeowners and renters. Nothing. Zero. Zilch going into property tax refund program or the renter's credit. They couldn't find a dime to assist townships, our smallest units of government, sometimes operating on amazingly small margins, benefiting from the township aid that was established 2 years ago to assist them in taking care of the roads and doing the things that the townships do. Not a dime to assist them. Not a dime to support the taxpayers in the 770 cities across the state that get local government aid, who rely on that for some portion of their city's budget, small, medium, large amount of their budget, it varies. Most of the money goes to Greater Minnesota, and those very taxpayers in Greater Minnesota who are counting on affordable government services to plow the roads, to repair the roads, to make sure the water is there when they turn on the tap in the morning or go to take a shower, who want to make sure that they've got the police and the fire protection that they need, not a dime in local government aid for those communities across the state to ensure that government services are provided efficiently, adequately, and affordably. County program aid. 25 counties in Greater Minnesota are being hurt by our current county program aid formula. Not only was there no willingness by the majority to do the work of looking at the formula, they wouldn't even accept their own members' proposals that did some of that work. Representative Backer had a good proposal on county program aid. You know, sometimes it takes the new guy who's willing to come in with a little energy and a little connection back to the community and say, you know, the county program aid isn't working for Greater Minnesota. We should reform that program. We should put some more funding in there. We could make sure that the Greater Minnesota counties that have to deliver all the services the state asks them to have the monies they need to do that. Representative Backer saw it. The leadership didn't. So Greater Minnesota hurts under the property tax division report. We've already talked about the property tax refund program and the renter's credit. Renters, particularly the elderly and disabled across the state, rely on that support to help pay down the property taxes that they pay through their rent. Not a dime in there for that. $1 billion in business tax cuts. Not a dime for mainstream middle-class Minnesotans in the property tax division report. In the face of a $2 billion budget surplus, I was shocked when it came out, and I remain stunned that the leadership of the majority is continuing to hold to that rather than respond to the needs of property taxpayers across the state. It'll shock you, Mr. Chair, that I will not be supporting the bill, but thank you for the sense of humor that you bring and the positive message that the positive approach that you take to chairing this committee each and every day. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Chair. Questions from members? Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And you know, I think we've had a really good discussion over this omnibus bill of yours today and the last several days over the division report. And we've heard certainly a lot of testimony, a lot of concern from the general public. And, you know, a couple of years ago when I first came to the legislature, one of the things that I kind of took upon myself was to take a look at this as an example, the angel investor tax credit. And I have to tell you that in, you know, in theory and in concept, I support it. I think it's good if the state of Minnesota turns around and invests monies in companies that are willing to invest in Minnesota and create jobs and generate revenue and increase our GDP. I think that makes really good sense. But as we move forward into, you know, this year and take a look again, and we had a Representative Anderson bill that increased monies into the Angel Investor Program, and the committee was able to amend that to make sure that 50% of it, you know, again went to Greater Minnesota and to businesses of minorities and women and such. But I think the overall theme is, when you look at a program like that, is that the majority, the vast majority of those dollars are going to the West Metro. So I question things like that. And it's not that I don't support the program, because I do. And I just think that it's time that this legislature and this particular committee especially starts taking a look at Minnesota's tax code. Because, and it's been said enough times here today, or I don't need to repeat it, but quite frankly, we have made this tax code far more complicated, and far more complicated than it needs to be. And I think that if you go out and ask average Minnesotans while you're door knocking about the complexity of the Minnesota tax code, you know, within two sentences, eyes start to glaze over, and you lose attention, and people don't understand it, and you can't explain it. There's easier ways to do things. And this constant increase in Minnesota's, at least the legislature's philosophy about increasing the amount of tax expenditures, I just don't understand it. 2 years ago, I think I had a bill that would have essentially mandated a sunset on every single tax expenditure in Minnesota's tax code. 300 of them at the time, I think it was, to a total of about $11 billion, if I remember right. $11 billion we spent, members, on 2 years ago that we spent on tax expenditures. We debate over a few million dollars spent on a program here or there. And we never look at tax expenditures. I mean, very rarely do we look at these things closely. So if we're going to spend, and now we're spending more, because I think with Chair Lencheski's testimony, you heard that we're increasing that expenditure, you know, clearly over $12 billion it'll be going into the next biennium. And we've also increased the number of tax expenditures. So going forward, what are we going to do? Are we going to continue to complicate our tax code? Are we going to continue to try to make people feel good that we're giving them a tax break or a tax credit? Making some change to the tax code that's going to benefit you? Is that what we're going to do to try to make Minnesotans feel like they're part of the system? Because that's not working, members. You know, I don't understand it. That's $11 or $12 billion that we could hand out to the actual committees to do work, do good work, on behalf of the constituents that are reflected in those committees. And I think that's the direction that we should be going. This session, I heard so much coming into this. You know, the rhetoric from the campaign was ridiculous about how we're going to make things so much better for Greater Minnesota, and the GOP is here, and we're going to work for you, and we're going to do everything, and we're going to, you know, stick it to those metro people. That's what we're going to do. But you didn't do that. You didn't pull that one off. You didn't. Because what you did is you stuck it to Greater Minnesota. Worse, there's a couple of things in this bill that are supposed to make them feel good, but you stuck it to them worse. And I don't get it. I just don't understand it. LGA. You know, I've talked LGA enough for the last couple of weeks. But there is a couple of comments that I want to make, because this is a different audience. I made it clear from the beginning when Representative Quam introduced his bill and we heard it in the division, and we had testimony and we had comments and we had discussion and we passed the bill. And then it showed up in Chair Druskowski's division report, and we talked about it again, and we had testimony and we had discussion. And clearly from the beginning of that discussion, my question was, why? Why must we do this? Because, Mr. Chair, and I would challenge anybody around this table right now to tell me that if we pass this provision into law where we reduce local government aid to the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, I challenge you to tell me why it's important in times of a $2 billion surplus why we need to raise property taxes on those residents of those three cities. Just somebody tell me why, because I've been asking for 2 weeks and I've got no answer. And that's what's going to happen here. And I'm going to talk about the city of Duluth because that's the one I happen to know the best. You, in this bill, Mr. Chair, are proposing to reduce Duluth's local government aid by 75% to the tune of $20 million, which is about, you know, roughly 25% of our general fund. And find me a business anywhere or a household that can accept a 25% reduction in income and pull that off without reducing services or increasing taxes. There's no way to get past that. And you've heard the testimony here that by doing this, you will increase taxes to 800,000 Minnesotans that live in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Okay? So the rhetoric that I hear about we don't believe in higher property taxes and we want to put things into place to reduce property taxes, I don't believe any of it. Because you're passing policy that will impact my district to the negative in terms of property taxes. And I don't know if you know this, Mr. Chair, but in my district, 32%, roughly a third, of my households make $25,000 or less, which is a significant percentage. And these are the people that I see every day. These are the people that I see every day when I go to my youngest daughter's school, or when I go to my oldest daughter's school, or when I try to go to, you know, one of her softball games, or we go to some event in the community. These are the families that I see each and every day that are struggling to make things work. I'm pretty proud of the fact that Duluth has rebounded from the recession in a very positive way, and we're seeing tons of things, positive things happening in our community with private investments. And I'm very proud of that. But the fact remains that I've still got a third of my households that are living on $25,000 or less. And that's not a lot of money, Mr. Chair. And this impact of this LGA cut is going to increase property taxes on those individuals that can afford to pay it the least. And I don't understand why. So I've been asking, Mr. Chair, members, you know, this repeated question about why, and I don't really have an answer yet, but some of the statements that I want to address that have been brought up regarding this issue, primarily heard in the division as we talked about LGA impacts. But Representative Quam stated that a first-class city receives three times the per capita aid but has 50% greater tax base per capita. And that was the initial premise, okay, when we first heard this bill and I asked the question why. It was about, you know, first-class cities, they receive three times, you know, the per capita aid. They just receive too high. And we now know that that's not true. But he was likely referring to my city, Duluth, and while it's true that Duluth's LGA per capita is nearly three times the state average, its average net tax capacity, which all of you should understand that term, is 21% below the statewide aggregate for cities. 21% below. In fact, two of the four first-class cities have average net tax capacity per cap below the statewide average for cities. So you start to wonder, okay, what's the common theme here? Why are we singling out these three first-class cities? Because we didn't single out all four first-class cities, just three of the four. Representative Hertaz stated that the number of cities getting zero LGA has increased, and that's just not true. What is true is that from 2002 to 2013, the number of cities getting zero LGA did increase from 19 to 124. Why? Largely due to the Pawlenty aid cuts in 2003. Under the new formula, which I should state, was put together 2 years ago with bipartisan support, with a large working group, and a much-needed change in the formula was passed into law. But under this new formula, the number of cities that get zero LGA went from 124 to 84. So 40 additional cities since 2013 are now receiving local government aid. So when Representative Huerta says the number of cities getting zero has increased, that's not really true anymore. He also stated that the LGA increase under the new formula was concentrated in the first class cities, which in theory would give you a reason why we need to reduce aid to those cities. And that's just not true either. When you look at the numbers from 2013 to 2016, statewide LGA has increased 21.5%. Among first class cities, that increase has been 20.1%. In fact, the only city with an LGA increase significantly above the statewide average is Rochester. How ironic is that? At 31%. But yet we're singling out Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. So what is the common theme? And I still don't know, Mr. Chair, why we're doing this, but the only thing that I can come up with now after hours and hours and hours of testimony and looking at this issue is that Republicans don't like Democrats. Right? That's got to be what it is. Because it can't just be a metro thing, because my city's not in the metro. It can't be a first-class city thing, because we didn't touch Rochester. It's got to be Democrats, because I really don't think that you, Mr. Chair, would willingly raise taxes on people that make relatively low amounts of money. I don't think that's in your heart. I just don't.
Well, Representative Simonson, I like Democrats.
I know you do. I know you do. I think down deep, you think that this is a horrible provision and that you're still going to fix it. But I just don't know why, Mr. Chair. It makes no sense to me. All we're doing is with this particular bill is that, you know, you're playing to some base that you were able to cut LGA to Duluth and Minneapolis and St. Paul, and really all you did was shift that cost onto local property taxpayers, 800,000 people in those three cities. I think that you've successfully interjected unfortunate politics into tax policy, and I think that's the wrong direction for the state. I think that I would be one more than willing to step up and say if you want to take politics out of tax policy, I'd be all for that. I'd be more than happy to work on that and try to figure out a way that we could do that. That's a huge undertaking, and I understand that. But sometimes, you know what? Good work is hard work, and you can do it if you take the time and put the effort into it. You know, in closing, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I paid attention to the testimony on your omnibus bill, and I won't say that I wrote down every single testifier, but I did keep pretty close track, and my numbers are that, you know, 40 people, individuals or people representing groups testified in opposition to your bill, and 6 were in support of. Those are not good numbers.
Representative Simonson, if you take vaping out, what are the numbers?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think there was only maybe 3.
66? you have the floor, sir. I'm sorry. Representative Simonson.
And I do appreciate your humor. It does make the day go by quicker. But I think, by and large, Mr. Chair, that even if you take the vaping provisions out,
I'm not going
to. But, you know, you bring that up. Maybe we should talk about that. But, sure. And I wasn't going to. But I think, you know, just in closing, that a lot of people are opposed to this bill for various reasons, and I certainly can't support it. But I think what I see when I, you know, to bring this back full circle, is that when I started, I talked about some of the promises that you all made on the campaign trail about supporting Greater Minnesota. And this is a primary failure for Greater Minnesota. And you can say that, you know, by hurting the metro, you gain in Greater Minnesota. But the reality is that the metro area, Duluth, St. Cloud, Mankato, these regional centers, these are the economic drivers of the state. Okay, if you keep poking at them, eventually it's going to have a trickle-down effect to everybody in the state. And I say that because I think this is one Minnesota. I don't think there needs to be these long-standing divides between the metro area and the rest of the state. I think that your priorities and your choices are off.
I don't like your estate tax bill.
I think that we've gone to some extremes here that we didn't need to go to, and I think that if anything, that you've only disappointed Greater Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I can't support your bill, although I was close at one time. I just can't pull this off.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Comments from members?
Yep.
Mr. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to read one quote from our founding fathers, and I'll be still. Just in my comment, listening to the minority's concerns about your great bill. And Thomas Jefferson, who I admire and read quite a bit, said this: "To take from one because it is thought that his own industry and that of his fathers has acquired too much in order to spare to others who or whose fathers have not exercised equal industry and skill is to violate arbitrarily the first principle of association, the guarantee to everyone of a free exercise of his industry and the fruits acquired by it." Mr. Chair, your tax bill does just that. You align with Thomas Jefferson and allowing people to keep the fruits of their energy and their work
he said,
and build for a stronger Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a great bill. I will support it.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Questions from comments from members? Okay, with that, Chair Lencheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I've kind of said it all, and I just again want to thank you so much for the way you've run the committee, and I really know that you, as you said, you know, I don't know exactly how you said it, but something, you were dealing with the hand you were dealt. I'm sorry you got such a bad hand. But we want to help you with that. You've been here a lot longer than I have, Mr. Chair, and so you certainly know how it works around here. And I know that you will work hard to represent the interests of the full House. Now, right now, I know this bill reflects the values of the majority, and I think we heard that as people, you know, walked through their objections. But you know, Mr. Chair, at the end of the day, you have to reflect the need of the entire body. Now, I know that it's unlikely that you're going to get a unanimous vote at the end of the day, although you were a conferee with me, and we actually got that last year, 100% off the floor and in conference, and it's possible. This one seems like it's a little bit of a stretch, but we do want to help you with that, and with all in all genuine seriousness, and I know we're going to meet tomorrow, as I heard you say, on the legacy bill or something, so we're not yet done here in this committee for this year. Unless you're going to pass a soccer stadium, I don't know that I... No? it seems that you only have a few more hearings left, so I do want to say, and I know you feel the same way, I personally, on behalf of our members, want to thank all the staff for the year. Ms. Richardson, Molly Richardson here, DFL staff, and all your Republican staff, and then all the nonpartisan staff, all the fiscal staff. There's a lot of people to name, the pages, of course. And normally I try to write them all down and read them all off, and I don't know, maybe you have that, Mr. Chair, but I know you feel the same way, that the work of the institution is remarkable, and the little secret that legislators know is it's the staff that makes us look good. It's the staff that answers all our questions, and if anybody in the public thinks we know anything, it's probably not us, it's probably the staff, and they're really an incredible group of people, and the taxpayers should know that they work for all of us on both sides of the aisle. I think lots of times taxpayers don't know that Minnesota has a nonpartisan staff. There are many legislatures that don't. There are many legislatures in the country that have only partisan staff, and when one body or the other takes it, they all get fired. And Minnesota doesn't work that way. We have a very group of top-notch, professional, nonpartisan staff, and I just genuinely want to thank them. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess we're going to get this voted out of here today, and you know, I'll be voting no, of course, but you know, I really hope you, as you go along, will really, as I said before, ask the minority genuinely, and I know Representative Thiessen, and that on the issues we care about, you know, for our input, because I think we're happy to provide it, and I think you know that to actually adjourn on time, which is less than 4 weeks away, your bill's going to have to work for this side of the aisle. I think when you're new to the legislature as a freshman, you just sort of believe that your team gets to win. And then you learn pretty quickly that isn't how it works around here. Things have to work for everybody or they don't work at all. So, again, I want to offer to you and our assistants, and I want to thank you so much for how you've conducted the committee this year and your fairness, and appreciate it very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Now, I don't anybody to misunderstand, when I was talking about the hand I was dealt, I was given $2 billion. That's pretty cool. I've got all these friends now, and I'm sure within 30 days I'll have fewer. With that being said, in putting this bill together, I do certainly want to thank the staff, the partisan, nonpartisan staff. I want to thank the GOP members, and I certainly want to thank the DFL members for we've had a lot of big issues here that could have become much more contentious. I'm very glad that we've operated in a gentlemanly type fashion, which I appreciate more than you know, because some of these issues could I'll just leave it at that. I appreciate the civility that this committee has operated under. That being said, I really did try to make this a bipartisan bill. Now, my definition may be different than your definition on what that consists of, but we didn't look at who authors were. We looked at what policy was. And I also want to thank this committee for you allowing me to hear all the bills we heard, even though the numbers get out of control. And so we made a lot of decisions and brought them in so that they work to this point. And we can debate as time goes on where those numbers are going to go. But I do want to thank the members from the GOP side for their provisions. I also want to thank the members that have provisions in this bill from the DFL side, whether it be the Earhart estate tax, the Ansel's bills regarding the Iron Range. I never understand those types of bills, but I guess it's pretty good. Representative Slocum, mm-hmm. We got to get that through. Somehow that has to be in the final bill. Chair Dabney, your education credits and deductions, I should say. Chair Carlson with the not-for-profits. We didn't just do one or two small ones. We did, I don't understand why we charge not-for-profit sales tax, but the bill gets through that. Rosenthal's provisions. Ray Dean on the, I think it's North Minneapolis,
yes.
Former library that's a kind of a deed place now. And then that's a thing that we shouldn't have problems with it like we have, but we correct that in the bill. Representative Dill, Sundin, Norton, Applebaum, Purcell, Johnson, Murphy, Simonson, Schoen, Mason, and Pinto. And I think that you realize that some chairs in the past, if you didn't vote for the bill, your provisions were not in there. That's not the way I operate. Your provisions are in the bill because I think they're good provisions. I will fight for the House position all the way through. But this bill does do quite a few good things, whether it be the dependent exemption, over 2 million Minnesotans will benefit from that. Married couple, two dependents, we can go through it. You know the numbers. The student loan credit, I think, is one issue I hope members will look at a little bit closer, because there's some really, I think, good provisions there. Social Security, reducing Social Security taxes, or what they pay, eliminating them from the state, the military pay, K-12 subtractions, the school bill, and for the folks out in rural Minnesota, the property tax provisions of house, garage, and half your acres makes a lot of sense. I certainly want to thank Chair Draskowski and the division for their work on the division report, and members. As you know, we know that this is not the final bill, because we know that I'm not going to have the $2 billion that I was given to design a bill. We're going to be somewhere in between the Senate and the House numbers, I'm sure, and we don't know what those are yet. I want to, whether you vote for the bill or not, I'd really appreciate your continued input. If you have something you need for your local district, let's talk about it and see where we go. So with that, if there's no further discussion, I will move House File 848. We have before us. I will now move the A15-0509 amendment as amended. Any further discussion? Hearing all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We now have House File 848 as amended before us. So the motion be to move House File 848 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, members, we're meeting tomorrow on the Erdahl bill. Thank you very much. Members, just don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.